Okay, I think we shall start the second round, which will be in English this afternoon. So welcome to everyone. We have several presenters, and we will start with Grete Flemmen, who's a researcher at St. Olav's Hospital in Trondheim, Norway. And her title is The Physical Health of People with Substance Addiction. How can it be assessed, and how can exercising or physical activity be facilitated? So welcome to you.
Thank you.
Sett dem på riktig, eller?
Ja, men det virker jo som menneske i det hele tatt.
Ja,
det
virker.
Yeah.
Kan du
snakke
sånn? Jeg kan gjøre det. Jeg tror ikke dere hører meg. Tusen. Skal vi kutt? Ja, du skal
egentlig bare hette den opp ørene.
Ja,
men
det var litt
greit. Han bøyde og bøyde. Ja,
jeg skal prøve å få den der.
Gå stort på hodet.
Kan du høre meg? Ja. Just start. First of all, I want to thank Hilde for asking me to come here and present our work. Thank you. I work at the Clinic of Substance Use and Addiction Medicine, which is a unit at the University Hospital in Trondheim. And I work in the Department of Research and Development. I finished my PhD about a year ago at the Department of Circulation and Medical Imaging at NTNU, which also is located at the university campus. Now I'm working with implementing physical exercise as part of the regular treatment program at the drug clinic. The patients in our clinic and in the studies I'm going to refer to today are patients diagnosed with substance use disorder, classified within ICD-10, F10 to 19, mental and behavioral disorders due to psychoactive substance use. Evidence of substance use disorder patients' physical health is scarce. We have hardly any studies that documents the health status of this patient population. Persons with substance use disorder have a decreased life expectancy of 20 to 30 years, which is the lowest among patients with different mental illnesses. Long-term substance use is associated with elevated risk of developing health problems. What we do know about this population is that they are high users of medical healthcare systems like hospitals, emergency departments, and treatment clinics. And they have elevated rate of lifestyle diseases, falls, fractures, and even suicide. Exercise capacity, a predictor of health, illness, and mortality. Cardiorespiratory capacity, how strong your heart is, and muscular strength are seen as two of the most important and basic components of physical health. And as I said, despite the knowledge of substance use disorder relations to medical challenges, there are barely any clinical studies identifying the frequency of somatic illness among substance use disorder patients and or measurements of their physical health or exercise capacity. If we as a treatment clinic want to include physical health as something we value as important aspect of drug treatment, we need to know what to treat. How is their physical health status when they arrive at the treatment clinic? There is a strong support in the literature that cardiorespiratory capacity, also called aerobic endurance, usually measured as VO2 max, is seen as one of the most important and basic components of physical health. VO2 max is linked to risk of disease and premature death. A low VO2 max is shown to give a larger risk of mortality compared to more recognized risk factors such as diabetes, high cholesterol, hypertension, and cigarette smoking. An improvement of VO2 max is shown to reduce the risk of mortality. Maximal muscle strength measured as 1 RM, one repetition maximum, that's how heavy load you can lift in one lift, has in recent years also received recognition as being one of the strongest predictors of physical illness and premature death. Low muscle strength is associated with increased incidence of falls and fractures, elevated risk of cancer and cardiovascular disease. Muscular strength is even shown to be an independent predictor of all-cause mortality in both patient populations and healthy populations. Reduced muscular strength is also shown to result in poor bone health, and with a lack of physical activity or resistance training, the consequences might induce bone loss. In the search for more knowledge about this patient population's physical health, we designed 4 studies. This ended in a 4-year research project and my PhD. The PhD project consists of 2 cross-sectional studies and 2 intervention studies. I will briefly show you the most important results from each of these studies. In the first study, we wanted to measure the physical health status of the substance use disorder patients while arriving in treatment. And this compared to the healthy population. Therefore, we aim to evaluate directly assessed VO2 max and maximal muscular strength. We also include the measurements of walking efficiency and rate of force development. We included 44 patients with substance use disorder in this study, 31 men and 13 women, which corresponds to the gender distribution in drug treatment in general. All patients were in residential 3-month treatment, long-term treatment, and they were not using drugs at the moment. The patient's physical performance was compared with a healthy age and sex match reference group. The reference group was targeted to exhibit what is typically observed in the healthy population. Results from the first study, how is the patient's physical health and capacity status when they first arrive in the drug clinic? The black bars here are the reference group, the healthy reference group, and the white bars are the patient population. The substance use disorder patients had a significantly reduced VO2 max compared to the healthy reference group. You can see this is for both genders, and also when we divided into different age groups, the reductions are the same. females displayed a group average reduction of 25% compared to references, and 15% reductions for the men. And these values can be compared to the healthy population that are 20 to 25 years older than themselves. So it's a 30-year-old patient has a heart capacity as a person that is 50, 40-year-old, 60, 65 years. And then their muscular strength measured as one repetition maximum in a squat movement. Not only is the cardiorespiratory fitness reduced, the patterns for strength is similar as the patterns for endurance capacity. You look at figure A here, the black bar is the same here, the reference group, and the white bar is the patient population. The substance use disorder patient had a significantly lower one repetition maximum compared to healthy controls. This shown as 30% lower group average in 1RM in males and 33% lower in the females, which also is at the level of healthy people 30 years older than themselves. The cardiorespiratory fitness and muscular strength impairments were systematically present regardless of kind of primary drug, which indicate that the low values may rather be caused by an inactive lifestyle than the direct effect of the drug use or the various drugs. These reductions imply that substance use disorder patients suffer a higher risk of developing cardiovascular disease, other lifestyle diseases, and early death compared to the healthy population. And figure B here shows that the patients also have a slower force development compared to the healthy reference group. So what can we do to improve their physical capacity? There is no surgery or pills that are effective to cure poor physical or low physical capacity. Exercise training, however, is shown to be an effective countermeasure for reduced endurance and strength. If we want to use exercise in clinical treatment of patients with substance use disorder, we need to use exercise training methods that we know are the most effective to reach the goal of a better physical capacity. We also need to know if the patient population responds to the training and that the training methods are feasible and applicable to the patient population. Training improvements are shown to be directly related to intensity, duration, and frequency of the training. Several studies have shown that high-intensity aerobic training is the most effective method to improve VO2 max. The same with strength training. Maximal strength training with high loads and few repetitions show larger improvements than training with moderate or low loads. Interval training with a high aerobic intensity of 85 to 95% of maximal heart rate is a training method that is shown very effective for improving cardiorespiratory capacity, the heart capacity. It is hard to work at this intensity for a long period of time. That is why the training is organized in intervals. The working periods can be from 3 to 8 minutes, with active rest in between. In my studies, we used the well-known 4x4 training method developed at NTNU. I'm sure you have heard about it. It's 4 minutes intervals and 4 working periods. It's a method that is easy to administer in a training setting. And the reason why it's 4 minutes is that your heart needs 2 minutes of high intensity training before the heart reaches the maximum or the intensity of the heart rate we want. And then the last 2 minutes of the interval is the most effective training for the heart. Then 3 minute active rest in between, and then 4 working periods. So a training session lasts for about 30 minutes. For the strength training, maximal strength training is a training method with high loads, 85 to 90% of 1 RM, and few repetitions. It's only 3 to 5 repetitions or lifts per set. And if you can do 5 repetitions, more weight will be added in the next set. When following these training methods carefully, paying attention to the recommended frequency, intensity, and duration, large improvements are achieved in a few weeks of training. The methods have been shown feasible and applicable for a range of different populations, athletes and untrained, young and old, healthy people, and from several patient populations. Given the reductions in the physical health measurements in the first cross-sectional study, we plan 2 intervention studies. Since the first study showed that the population had a significant reduced physical health compared to the healthy population, we wanted to see if it was possible to restore the patient's health by exercise training. And important questions were if the population responded to training despite their earlier massive drug use, and was the training methods feasible in the population? In the first intervention study, we aim to examine the feasibility and effect of high-intensity interval training in substance use disorder patients in clinical treatment. In the second study, intervention study, we aim to investigate the feasibility and effect of maximal strength training intervention for substance use disorder patients in clinical treatment. In both studies, 24 patients with substance use disorder were included. They were randomized into a training group and a control group. In the first study, the patients in the training group received supervised high-intensity interval training 3 days a week for 8 weeks. In the second study, the training group received maximal strength training 3 days a week for 8 weeks. The control group had treatment as usual. This also included physical activity. To make a long story short, the results, some of the results and conclusions from the study. High aerobic intensity interval training and maximal strength training restored the substance use disorder patient's physical health to a level similar to what is observed in the healthy population in 8 weeks. After 8 weeks of high-intensity interval training and maximal strength training, the patients were no longer at high risk of developing cardiovascular disease and lifestyle diseases. One of the objectives of the intervention studies was to see if the population was able to follow the training regime for 8 weeks. I think I was the only one that believed that that was possible. In both studies, 9 out of 12 patients completed the training intervention, which is a dropout rate that is normal in even the healthy population. But I did all the physical tests of the patients, and I followed every training session and every interval, standing right beside the patient. For 8 weeks, I think that was an important factor. And the training facilities was in the clinic, where the patients were staying. So I even, if they didn't show up for training, I walked up the stairs, and sometimes I even had to go in and get them out of bed. But they were happy after the session. But it's a lot of work. Our results from the study suggested that the training interventions carried out in this study should be advocated as a part of the substance use disorder treatment programs. And now we have an exercise training clinic at the clinic at St. Olav's, the drug clinic. From January this year, structured exercise training has become a part of the treatment program at the drug clinic at St. Olav's Hospital. This part of the treatment is likely valued as other parts of the treatment program, like group therapy, appointments with psychologists, and so forth. The main goal with the exercise training as part of the treatment program is to improve the patient's cardiorespiratory health and muscular strength, and in that way reduce their high risk of cardiovascular disease, other lifestyle diseases, and early death. All residential patients had 3 sessions and training appointments per week in the 3 months they are staying at the clinic. Some of the residential patients continue treatment after those 3 months in the outpatient department and can thereby keep training in the exercise training clinic. The outpatient department has exercise as treatment as a part of their treatment as well, and their treatment also lasts for 3 months, and if needed, the patients can use the facilities longer. The training methods are the same as in the intervention studies. They come in and do your interval training first on the treadmill, running or walking, and if they have any injuries, they have a bike and a roller machine. And when they're done with that part of the training, they do like the picture upright, a hex squat movement, and that's the only strength training we do. They do 4 sets in that machine. So it's a squat moment. We want to at all times use the documented most effective training methods to improve cardiorespiratory health and muscular strength. We have 2 highly qualified employees in the exercise training clinic, both physiotherapists with a master and a PhD in exercise physiology who supervises every training session. The training is adapted to each patient's physical capacity, medical challenges, or possible injuries. In the first training session, we test their maximal heart rate and maximal strength so we can estimate the training intensity they should work at. In one way, the exercise training is now a part of the treatment program, but the implementation work is not finished. The support from the head of the clinic has been invaluable. She has followed the work from I started planning the studies and all the way till today. Changes in treatment structures is a long process among the employees at the clinic, and the resistance definitely is present at all times. Status today is about that 60% of the patients attend their 3 scheduled training sessions a week, which I think is pretty good this early in the implementation process. Our goal is 100% attendance, and we have continuously information about the training methods, why we exercise as we do, and why this is a part of the treatment. To the leaders, employees, and the patients, we hope to increase the attendance. the feedback from the patients that attend the training sessions in our exercise training clinic is mostly positive. They say they get motivated by the fast improvements of their physical fitness. They report positive effects on their mental health, and they are happy with themselves for being able to complete the training. These are possible effects we like to document in future research. We have to see if improving the patient's physical health has impact on their life when it comes to drug use and other parts of their rehabilitation. That is all. Okay, thank you.
We have time for some questions. Yes?
Did something happen with their substance abuse following this intervention? Do you know?
I haven't had time to follow them after the training interventions. But we hope to do this. We have a research project going, so we will follow today's patients through their treatment, and 3 months after, 6 months after, and a year after. And it would be even interesting to see 5 years after also. But in my PhD project, I didn't have time. It was I spent a little bit more than 2 years to collect the data.
I have one question as well, because we were talking earlier today that of course, it's very important to feel that your body is strong and fit. It also gives you a new identity. But the social, we've spoken about the psychosocial, where the human being is part of that. And I was thinking when you were talking, you were the sort of the psychosocial environment as well, standing by them when they were doing the tests and exercising.
Yeah, I was.
So for the follow-up, have you any ideas or thoughts?
Yes, because when I did the interventions, I was probably the person in the treatment system they met the most.
Yeah.
Our training facility is arranged, so it's kind of like a gym.
Yeah. So like SUPS or something.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they all have individual training. Tits point.
Yeah, times or
time. Yeah, yeah. So the patients are coming and leaving, and and it's kind of social there. But were you thinking after this?
Yes, I was because we're this street soccer thing, which is the team building, the social feeling, part of something bigger than yourself, and actually also practicing the social sociale ferdigheter, your social capacity to actually interact with people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think by improving their physical health, and they can feel, and they can even see, because we write down the intensity they have on each training session, how they improve their strength, so they know they are in good shape, like everybody else, and that makes it easier to go to
a team or whatever.
Yeah.
It would be very, very interesting to follow your further research.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Yes. I was about to ask the same question, because did you observe that the patient had a broad network when it comes to people whom they hang around with? Because they say that a brother in sweat is a brother indeed. Because they be talking about the same thing, like, oh, how is the beginning feel? Oh, what do you have? What are the tips? Yeah. Do you understand what I mean? Like, maybe on the wrong ground, they will have more friends on ground, which will make them not going back to the substance abuse. Yeah, in the same spirit of your question, they had more socialized, they were keen to socialize more because they had about the aspect of things they talk about. Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, you can do it. Yeah.
I could see that the patients that are outpatients, they have they live outside the clinic and come in and mm-hmm. train 3 days a week. This group has a social.
Oh yeah, they meet.
Yes, this is their. They say this is important in their daily life appointment in the training clinic.
I think we should just round up there because I think this is an example of something which is new and which is not implemented many places, which also empowers these patients, which I think is a very important part of the whole picture. So
yes, and just our main goal is to improve their physical capacity.
Yeah.
And yes. We also work with Trondheim kommune, and they have some. They want to take this further when the patients are done in treatment.
Thank you very much. It was very interesting. So our next speaker, we will just continue. It's Morten B. Randers from University of Southern Denmark in Odense. He is a researcher, and his title is Health Effects of Street Soccer in a Group of Male Players. So welcome to us, and the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you for the presentation. And first of all, I'd like to thank the organizing committee for inviting me here today to talk a little about some of the projects that we have conducted on the health effects of street soccer. And as you said, the title was on male players, but I have a little bit, not much, but we have a little bit on female players as well. My background, these studies are part of my PhD, which I finished in 2011. And since that, I've been working at the University of Copenhagen on the Center of Team Sports and Health, where we study different kinds of team sports and the health effects of that. But right now, I'm at the University of Southern Denmark. We have conducted a lot of studies on football, recreational soccer. And several of these studies have shown that there's a very positive broad spectrum health effects, irrespective of age, sex, social status, the skill level, and prior experience of soccer, both in healthy individuals, but also different patient groups, such as diabetics, hypertensive people, and we have also conducting on prostate cancer patients, and right now on breast cancer patients. So actually, the FC Prostate won the Danish what's called the Idrætsprisen last year. So, but we have conducted several studies on this topic, and. And we have seen that football or soccer, recreational soccer, is a broad spectrum training categories. As you just heard, it's important to have high intensity training, which is very effective for cardiovascular fitness. But when we play football, there's also a lot of moderate intensity. You know, the intensity varies all the time. Then you're sprinting, then you're walking, then you're running, and then you tackle, shooting. So we also have these strength and bone impacts. We have a lot of turns, and then we sprint. And this gives us a physical activity, which impacts metabolic fitness, cardiovascular fitness, musculoskeletal fitness, and that way it affects a lot of the lifestyle diseases. But today, it's all about street soccer. This is from Copenhagen, Rolfsberg in Copenhagen. And today I'll present some of the results for some of the few studies that we have published in this area. We started, I think, 10 years ago to measure the heart rate response in the homeless male national team. I think in 2007 it was in Copenhagen, actually. And that was the time that we started collaborating and conducting some of these data. And what we saw was that the mean heart rate was quite high, almost over 84%, and peak heart rate almost at maximum in some time of this. And actually for 33% of the playing time, the heart rate was about 90%, as you just heard. That's important. So, and when we compare homeless men here, when we compare them to some of the other study groups, untrained men, untrained female, elderly men, and middle-aged men, we see that the heart rate response, at least, were similar to when we're playing 5 against 5 or 7 against 7 small-sided games. So, in close collaboration with Umbol, we conducted a study, a 12-week training study, where homeless and socially deprived played football 3 times a week and had 1 time a week of fitness and training. And during the intervention period, we were able to recruit 55 subjects. As you know, it's a difficult population group, so even before the pretest, some of them were ruled out, some didn't show up, and some had some severe problems, so they couldn't be included. But we ended up with 22 in the street soccer training group and 10 in the waiting list group that we included in the study list. We have data from pre and post testing. So the training intervention, as I said before, it was 3 times per week. They played 4 against 4, just as you maybe have seen here on Rådhuspladsen. So the official rules, goalkeeper. What was important was remember to change the goalkeeper, because as you've seen, the goalkeeper had to stay in his area or her area, but this is only men. The training was supervised, and coaches encouraged them to be involved in the game. And we know that coach encouragement means a lot to the intensity. And all of these sessions start with 10 minutes of low intensity warm-up, dribbling and low intensity running and so on. The fitness in the training was 1 time per week. 50-minute low to moderate intensity warm-up on cycle ergometer or cross trainer. And then they did 5 exercises in machines with not as high intensity as we saw before, but pretty low intensity and main for the upper body. We have quite a high attendance rate, 55%. So in average they train 2.2 sessions per week, street soccer, and a little less in the fitness center. So the test included blood sample after an overnight fast, where we measured for blood lipids, liver proteins, blood glucose, insulin, and different bone markers. We measured the blood pressure, the resting heart rate. We also did a whole body DEXA scan and measured the quadriceps muscle mass anthropometrically. And after that, they had a meal and waited for 1.5 hours before we were doing an incremental test to exhaust it on a cycle ergometer. And as you see, the balance were quite bad, and that is why we chose to use a cycle ergometer instead of just on a treadmill. On a separate day, we measured the postural balance, and we also did sprint test and the yo-yo intermittent endurance test for the ones. And we also measured the training intensity and the daily activity pattern, and used some pedometers and heart rate monitors, video filming, not during the everyday life, we were not walking behind them and videotaping everything, but we videotaped the training sessions to do computerized time motion analysis. We saw just before that maximal oxygen uptake is very important for the health status. And what we found in our study was that after 12 weeks, we had 3.9 milliliter per minute per kilo improvement in VO2 max. And this change was also different from the control group. And we know that actually 3.5, a similar increase in maximal oxygen uptake, means a 50% reduction in the risk of developing cardiovascular diseases, and also a 10 to 25% decrement in mortality risk. So, huge improvement just in 12 weeks. We didn't see any change in the blood pressure. And that was actually quite different to what we have seen when we played 7 against 7 in untrained men and untrained women. And they decreased 8 millimeter mercury in systolic and 5 in diastolic blood pressure, and even greater in hypertensive patients, but we didn't see any change in this population group. But for 6 out of 9, we saw a decrement in systolic for those that have p-values above 115 millimeter mercury, and 8 out of 8 with diastolic blood pressure above 75, but that is way below. Normally we say hypertension is 140 above 90, but we have seen that actually improving or lowering the blood pressure down to at least these numbers have significant health improvements. So even though we didn't see any changes in the mean values on the whole population group, we did see none of those. The resting heart rate also dropped from 65 to 61 beats per minute, but the change was not different from the control group, so we can't say it was due to our intervention. We didn't see any changes in the blood glucose, insulin, or triglycerides. But for cholesterol, LDL cholesterol, it decreased from 3.1 to 2.7 in the subgroup. And especially those with the highest prevalence had significant or marked decreases also in total cholesterol. When we look at the body composition, actually you can see here the BMI is quite normal, the weight is quite low, but in this group we had some which had very low body weight, but also some of them, they were quite obese. So, a quite heterogeneous group. But after the 12 weeks of summer training, we had lowered the fat mass, and we saw a small improvement in the lean body mass, which also led to a decrement in the total fat percentage. We also saw that this street sugar had an improvement in osteocalcin, which is a bone formation marker in the blood. But we didn't see any change in the whole body BMD, nor the bone mineral density in the legs. But 12 weeks to change the bone so we can measure is probably also in the lower end. So maybe if we could measure this after a longer period, then it would have changed to a stronger bones. And is that important? Yes, it's important, because we know that part of those from this special group, which is hospitalized, comes in with bone fractures. So can we give them stronger bones? They are less unlikely to have bone fractures. But another thing is the postural balance, because we can make them better not to fall in the first place. And actually, we saw a huge decrement in number of falls when we tested the postural balance. So what are causing these marked health effects? And we looked at the daily activity, and on these days where they're not engaged in street soccer, they actually, on average, walk more than 10,000 steps. And at least at that time, the media always said, you just have to walk 10,000 steps per day, then you are healthy, then all's good. The soccer session, during the soccer session, it was almost 5,500 steps. And interestingly, those days where they were engaged in soccer, they didn't walk less outside. Because you can see the sum of the daily activity on a day without soccer and soccer session more or less gives the same daily activity on these days with soccer. So, but what about the heart rate response? And what is very interesting is that in those days where they didn't play soccer, where they only had a normal daily activity, as you see the black bar, the heart rate were very low. It's normal though, because they were just walking. And actually only for less than 3 minutes per day in average, the heart rate was above 80% of maximal heart rate, and never above 90%. Whereas the fitness was a little bit higher, but as you see, the football training gave high heart rates, and 21% above 90% of maximal heart rate, which, as we just heard, leads to several positive cardiovascular health effects. So, daily activity, very, very little intense, whereas the soccer session, as you see, more than 60%, 65% actually, of the total training time, the heart rate was above 80% of maximum heart rate. And what is causing these high heart rates? Is that when you play street soccer, there's a lot of changes in activity. It's not like when you're running 5 kilometers, you're doing the same. Maybe you need a red light, so you have to stop, but you're running with the same pace for 20 to 30 minutes, if you're running 5 kilometers, And the stimulus on the body is quite circular. It's the same you're doing. But when you play street soccer, there's a lot of changes. You're standing, walking, jogging, low speed, moderate speed, high speed running, sideways, sprinting. Maybe it's not sprinting like maximal speed because, you know, the pitch is 22 meters long, so you can't reach your maximal speed, but at least you're doing maximal accelerations. So, and you can see here on the right column, time of action is very short, so your changes change their activity all the time. And in this study, we saw that during 1 hour, they covered in total 5.5 kilometers, which I think is a little overestimated. This old method was video time motion. Now we have GPS, which is more precise, and they measure a little bit less than this. But at least the activity is changing all the time. And as we have heard a lot today, it's not, and as Nicholas said just before lunch, it's not just about the body and thinking on the body like an error, but also all these social things. And Birgitte also did a master project on this, where she looked on the Danish homeless scene, and a major part of this was the huge increase in self-esteem. They were building social capital, and what I experienced was that it's no fun to be late to football because then the football game is over. So you have to be there on time, which is not what these guys are best at. So, but it's no fun to be 1 hour late because then the game is over and they want to play the game. So they learned to be there on time and stuff like that. So there have also been some British studies and just short about that. They have done a community-based program with some of the Premier League clubs. And they found that it was a very powerful way to recruit these hard-to-reach men. How they had a lot of dropouts and low attendance. They trained 2 times 2 hours. Their heart rate were quite lower than what we saw. But they also did a lot of technical precision plays and stuff like that, whereas ours were mainly small-sided games. And this graph shows that these are individuals, but it clearly shows that when you play small-sided games, as we see on Rødfletten, then the heart rate is very high. And actually, I think most of them also think it's fun, the most fun part, just to play. So why not do that? In that study, or in these studies, they actually didn't find any improvements in these things that they measured. And yeah, I know tables are terrible because there's a whole lot of data, but I just want to show another study that we just conducted some years ago, where we compared street soccer with boards around compared to not playing with boards around, because not all of us have access to pitches like here or grass pitches actually, but can it be played, I guess? And yes, the boards keep the ball in play, so as you'll see here, the mean heart rate is higher when you play with boards because you don't have the stops all the time when the ball is out of play. But you're also running less, and your intensity, running intensity, is lower. because you know the pits was the same size, but when you have a board, you have to stop before running into it. So the pits becomes even smaller. So it can have these high running speeds. And when we compare it to playing on the grass field, we can see all of these are 3 versus 3 and same protocols. But as you see, when you play on a grass field sized like a handball pitch, you run nearly 1.5 kilometers longer, and you have a lot more high speed running. High speed here is above 13 kilometers. But even though we have the heart rate, which is very high, so at least we can stimulate the heart and the cardiovascular system by playing street soccer or playing in the park on a grass field. Shortly about the women, these data are from Brazil when we had our national women's team playing there, and we didn't know the maximal heart rate, so we couldn't present these relative, but as you see, this is above 180 feet per minute, which roughly could be close to above 90%, and here 160 to 180, so they had more than 75% of the playing time was above the heart rate above 160. Even though, and we measured these with GPSs, so even though that the speed of the movement are quite low, but they are always changing directions and changing activity, and you see less than half of the movement is forward running, and sideways running, backwards running is causing a lot more, and the body is causing a lot more energy. We haven't done a long-term training study on women, but that's definitely something that we would like to do. So, in conclusion, street soccer programs can be an attractive activity to engage homeless and other hard-to-reach populations in physical activity, which may lead to important health improvements. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Mahmoud. We have room for one or two questions. If there are anyone who wants to, yes?
Yes, thank you so much for a very interesting presentation. However, I wonder, usually soccer are associated with different kinds of injuries in the body. Do you have any attention on that aspect?
Yeah, not in this specific group, but in a lot of these studies we have done, the difference is that when you play with people you know, then you take care in a whole other way. So we don't see tackles in the knees, and we don't see, of course, injuries happens, but we have found injuries in 1 to 500, one injury per 500 to 700 hour of exposure. So when you train 2 times 1 hour per week or two times 2 hours per week, then you will get maybe one injury per year, and only 10% of these injuries are severe. So we see much lower injuries here than in professional or amateur soccer, where you are playing against the neighbor town and you go like this. Maybe you'll see more here because now they're competing. But when they play at home, they play together with their friends, so that they take care of each other in another way. And in some of the groups we have started in Denmark, football fitness, and some of the clubs actually have men and women above 60 to 84 is the oldest, but they have a rule that they can step on the ball. Because when they step on the ball, something happened, and then they get injured. So they have made the rule, they can't step on the ball. So of course you can do this to avoid injuries. Yeah.
Okay. Hare Krishna.
Would you say that the physiological responses of this group in any way is different from otherwise healthy but untrained persons?
If they're different,
yeah.
The health effects? No, it's similar.
Yeah.
It's similar. So, but we didn't see a change in blood pressure, but blood pressure were already low. And maybe, I don't know if the cannabis abuse, which is high in this group, may affect some of these things, but yeah.
Will you get high or low blood pressure from cannabis use?
I'm curious about DEXA scan.
Yeah.
Of the players, because you had blood markers for bone production. But did you look at the measures for their bone quality?
Yeah, and we didn't see any change in bone mineral density, neither in the legs or in the whole body.
Oh.
And we sometimes see small changes in that. Actually, in the study on untrained femur, we did a PQCR scan, which is more precise, and then we saw change. Also in the prostate cancer, we have seen improvement. So in some groups, but no statistical change in this group.
So I looked at bone quality in amphetamine users. They have poor bone quality compared to
other drugs.
I think we have to round up for the last answer. So thank you very much. We have a small question. Now, we'll just continue in our program. We have had two sort of research reports. Now I have the pleasure to introduce Lisa Reisman, who is the founder and chief executive of the national team of football from the United States. Is that right?
In Sacramento. Yeah.
In Sacramento, okay. Yeah. And I just met her a couple of days ago. I think it was fantastic to get in touch with you. And she's promised to tell her story and also to tell a little bit about her, or a lot about her work with the women's team.
Yeah.
So, welcome. Water? Yeah, we can get water. Okay. Do you want me to speak to you, or do you want to speak on your own?
What's that?
You're speaking on your own, huh?
Yeah, I can. Can you hear me? Is that loud? Okay. So my name is Lisa Reisman, and I'm from Sacramento, California, in the United States. We're here coaching the United States women's national team that's competing in the Homeless World Cup this week. And we've been coaching it for, Tiffany is the other coach who's sitting in the audience as well. We've been coaching it for the last, 7 years. And thank you. I've been like yelling a lot, so like a lot of coffee, a lot of yelling. So if my voice starts to tank, let me know. But I've been involved for about 7 years, and I think I've coached the women's team at the National Cup. I mean, at the Homeless World Cup for the last 6 or 7. So we've coached in Paris, Mexico City, Chile, Poland, Amsterdam. We were in Scotland last year. So it's really cool to be all around the world, and each hosting country does different events. So it's really great that you guys are all here kind of doing research and sharing it. And so how I got involved in the Homeless World Cup was I was actually a player about, 2010. I was a player in the Brazil Cup. And how I got involved in that was through a drug addiction that I had. And so it became eligible for the Homeless World Cup. But I grew up playing soccer since I was about four or five, and it was always my passion, and I was really good at it, and that's where I wanted to spend all of my time. I played in college at Sacramento State University, which is a Division I school, in California, and I did really well there. And my goal was to go to play professional soccer. And in the United States, they were just starting to develop the Professional Women's League. So while I was studying at the university, I was still getting my grades up, but I was really being encouraged to focus on going into the pro league. And when I got done with college, the pro league folded. So what they had built, they didn't have enough funding, so it just kind of collapsed. So I didn't really know what to do next, and I tried to play semi-pro for a few years, hoping that the pro league would reopen and then I could go play. But in the time between finishing college and playing semi-pro and trying to work enough so where I could have money and then also train, there was still a big void that I was missing, and it was from like having that team and having that support and having that you know, regular training and games and things to look forward to. So I got really heavy into drugs. I drank a lot in college, but I was able to manage it between my games. So if I had a game, I wouldn't drink a couple days before. So I was able to kind of manage it that way. But when I didn't have those games anymore, like I got pretty out of control, and it went from drinking to like a lot of painkillers. I was on painkillers for a really long time, to methadone. I tried to get myself off of painkillers by giving myself methadone. And then when I tried to get off of methadone, I couldn't sleep for like a month. So I thought I would use meth. I was like, well, if I'm going to be up, I'm going to be doing something. And that was where it got like really bad for me. I'm sure, I don't know what the amphetamine use is like in Norway, if it's bad or not. Have you guys ever met anybody who's using methamphetamines? It's a bit of a disaster. So I was that crazy person, you know, on the street, and I was very paranoid, and I believed that there were spaceships, and the FBI was watching me, and, you know, and I was really, you know, out there, and this was using the drugs for maybe 9 months total. So I went from being like the best person in my college team and in line to go pro, and then now I'm like this crazy person wrapping everything in tinfoil, worrying about who's following me, and there's nobody there. So it wasn't really going well for me. Luckily, I actually got arrested. The last time I got arrested, I was also doing like very weird things, and that's pretty much why they arrested me. It's like, do you know what you're doing out here? And I was like, I'm studying the environment. And I remember I had a crack in my windshield. My car was like in the middle of this empty lot late at night, and I was just there. And a store near me had been robbed. And so I made sense to, you know, they obviously thought it was me that had robbed it. I didn't even know this place had been robbed. So it's like, I've been out here testing the air and journaling and, you know, tracking all the satellites going by. And it was so bad that there was a crack in my windshield, and I believed that there were bugs coming through. So I had super glued like the inside of my windshield, and I had a lot of cleaning supplies in my car, you know, and so like this was kind of like what I had turned into. And luckily that night they charged me with the robbery that happened near me. But the good thing about that was I got taken to jail, which is probably where I should have been, very safe and like unable to harm the community. It's like I had just gotten so disconnected from a functional life that like I kind of had lost all senses of like what was normal. And so that was the last time that I got arrested. That was also the last time I used drugs. And in jail, it was a little bit depressing again to think like, I don't know what the systems are like here, but in the United States, they're very bad. Like in a local county jail or in a prison, it's a concrete box that you basically stay in for 23 or 24 hours of the day, zero communication with the outside. They don't tell you very much, so it feels indefinite. It is a very hopeless space. You know, and I had gone to college and I had gotten a degree that I no longer believed I was going to be able to use, because now I'm a robber and I have, you know, felonies and things like that. But it was also hard for me to kind of wrap my mind around, how did I go from being so good at something and then fail so bad? And it's like, what am I going to do with my life? And so, you know, a term you hear a lot of alcoholics or drug addicts is like, we, you know, hit our bottom. And that was definitely my bottom. And then there was a lot of weird things that happened in jail too, that you're just like, how is this my life? Like, this is crazy. So a couple of things that happened that really like motivated me that if I were able to make a change, I wanted to make it. So I did get the opportunity to leave. They let me out of jail. But you know, my mom's actually here today, and I remember her coming to visit me, and I was like, hey, you got to get me out of here. And she's like, I can't, like, you're a liability. And I was like, you're right. Like, fair enough. So when I did get out, I went to a rehab, and I felt, I didn't know very much about addiction, or I never knew an alcoholic that I wanted to be like growing up. So I also never wanted to end up being an alcoholic who needed help. Because my idea of drug addiction and alcoholics were very unhealthy people. I had never met somebody who was like, oh, I used to be an alcoholic, now I'm doing great. And so when I went to rehab, it was kind of my first exposure to people who knew how I felt. And that was a big relief for me because I had all these struggles for so many years that I felt like nobody really knew how I felt. And so that was helpful. But then I also met all these other people that we had very different lives, all these women, very different lives, but we all had the same feelings and emotions. We had been hopeless. We'd felt like this for a long time. We were trying lots of different ways to make life work, and it just wasn't. So it was the first time I had kind of experienced what sobriety and recovery looked like. And I was very happy about it because, like, this is what I've been looking for a long time. And then after my rehab, I went to a transitional living where I was introduced to the street soccer program in my town. And it was a men's team. They didn't have a women's team. And they were super bad. Like, terrible. Because the United States also, like, people don't always, not everybody grows up playing soccer. Mostly it's a game of privilege. So a lot of the underserved or marginalized people, like, they didn't play while they were younger. So this team of men was, like, this hardcore guys who all had criminal records, like, not a lot of teeth, a lot of tattoos, and, like, big, like, they looked like, American football players trying to play soccer, you know, like, and they wanted me to play with them. I was like, no, thank you. Like, I'm good. And I also felt like I had committed so much of my life to soccer. Like, I didn't want to do that again. Like, in my mind, playing soccer was not helpful for me. It's like, I was very good at it, but when I wanted to go try to get other jobs, like, none of those skills seemed to transfer for me. Like, nobody cared that I was really fast or I could score goals. They're like, can you, you know, send, you know, organize or, I don't know, manage people. And in my mind, those were not skills that I had. So they wanted me to play with them. And they were getting ready to go compete in a national tournament in the United States, which is Street Soccer USA is our organization, and it's across the country. And every year they have this big tournament where all the teams from around the country, you know, look forward to going. So it's like 16 cities have these teams. And they were getting ready to go to the tournament, and they thought that if I played with them, they'd win. And so they kept trying to, like, get me to play, and I was like, no, like, I need to get a job. Like, I need to focus on my recovery. I don't want to play soccer with you guys. And ironically, the only things I had never given away or tried to sell were my cleats. So I still had those. And then one day they finally, you know, convinced me to go out and play, and it was this really crappy piece of grass. And I'm used to, like, nice soccer fields and gear and equipment and soccer balls. I mean, like, a couple soccer balls, crappy little grass area, you know, no goals or anything like that. And it was the most fun I had had in, like, at least a couple years. And so after that day, I, like, committed to playing with them and go on to this tournament. But it was really interesting to me because, like, I always played soccer. When I look back now, I realize, like, it was, like, my space of freedom and expression. I always felt like that was where I felt the most free. And then this was, even in this little crappy grass area that we're playing, it again, it was kind of like what I felt free and you know, felt good for the first time. And I had probably been depressed for at least 6 or 7 years. And when you're kind of depressed or hopeless for so long, you forget that you've been happy before. So this started, like, really kind of making me reflect back, like, oh yeah, like, I used to be happy. Like, I haven't always been this way. So that was kind of like one of the immediate things that happened when I went and played. But then we went to this tournament, you know, and it was I think I was 6 months sober. And, you know, we're all brand new in our sobriety. So we've got, like, our AA books, and, like, we're going to go travel and we're going to have our little meetings so nobody loses it and runs away and go drinks. But we got to this tournament. And it was also the first time many of us had left, like, this transitional living. So I don't know how much time you spent around rehabs or folks through it, but it's very scary. And we're also, like, hadn't seen normal people in a very long time. So we're, like, traveling and just like, oh, my God, like, everything was very exciting. And you know, we get to Washington, D.C., and it was this big festival on a smaller scale, similar to what the Homeless World Cup looks like, but for a three-day period. So they use the mini pitches the same way the soccer field. So they put it in a really iconic space in the city that's exciting to be at. And then it's music, kind of like a festival. And all the players have been homeless. So you know, one of the things that happened when we got there is we got shoes, we got uniforms similar to this, and it just felt really good. But we're used to being treated in a negative way for being a drug addict or a criminal or making mistakes. And like, they welcomed us with just open. They were like, "We're so happy you're here." And we hadn't been treated that way ever. It was like, "What do you mean?" Like, they're like, "Thank you for coming." You're like, "No, thank you for having us." Like, I didn't understand why they were saying thank you. But what we learned after that tournament, you know, we didn't win at all. We didn't come close. But what we learned after that tournament was, you know, they really valued the steps that we were making to not give up. And they really appreciated the hard work that it took to maybe stay sober when the rest of our communities didn't understand what that was. Like, nobody's ever happy to, you know, nobody was really happy that I was an alcoholic. They're like, "Oh, we're so happy about this. Like, congratulations." You know, and it doesn't mean it's hard to work hard to stay sober, but it just means that, like, you know, it was nice to be received. And they also recognized the value that it meant for the the world when people can turn around the lives, because if they don't turn it around, it's going to continue to harm the communities. So after that event, I was nominated to play in the Homeless World Cup in Brazil, and it was really exciting. It wasn't really the World Cup that I wanted to play in, like, growing up, and I didn't like. I had friends that I had played with that were actually on, like, the United States women's team. You're like, "This is all right." And I thought, like, in my mind, I was like, "Okay, I'm going to go to this Homeless World Cup, and I'm going to play so good that I'm going to become a pro afterwards." And then when we got to Brazil, I met my teammates, and we were not going to win a game. Like, it was, like, not going to happen. And my team, we had ages from 18 to 60. We had it was the first women's team from the United States, all women's team. From all over cities, so we had never played together before. And most of the women had maybe a year experience of playing. It was very messy and it was ugly. And after our first game, I realized, like, we're not going to win. The liberating part of that was we stopped thinking about winning, and the rest of the tournament, we were able to think about all the other things that we're to do, like to connect with people and hear their stories and just be a part of. And what I also learned about my teammates, although they were really bad, and this was kind of a profound thing for me as a competitive player, although they were really bad, they were still able to get all of the benefits that an elite athlete would get from being on a team. Like, they were so prideful to have a uniform that had a positive reference. It wasn't a jail number. It wasn't, you know, some kind of, like, county or prison negative jersey. It was a positive thing. And they loved soccer. Like, they were obsessed with it. They would wake up in the morning and they're like, "But they were still so bad." And you're like, "This is crazy. Like, this is what wakes you up every day. And this is, like, motivating them to live their life. And they weren't good." And it just blew my mind, because most people only do the things they're good at. And so this is a really unique space that allowed that, though. Like, they didn't need to be good. They needed to be moving forward in their life. So for me, it was a kind of an opportunity, because I kind of saw how much they wanted to learn, and I didn't really have anything in my life that I felt I had a value. But I have, like, years of experience of soccer. So I didn't have anything. I didn't have any money. I didn't have a job. Like, there's nothing else I could have offered my team besides, like, my knowledge of soccer. And I had never had a desire to coach, but it was like, I mean, they just wanted to learn how to dribble. Like, how do you pass it? And so that was kind of how we spent the week. And that was really what built a cool team culture for us. We finally won a game. It was against Norway, actually. I still, like, you know, I saw some of the players that I played with in Brazil last year at the Homeless World Cup, that from the Norway team. That was our big win. And it was, like, 7-8, and I had scored all 8 goals. But we won it together, you know, and it was very impactful, but it sat with me, and it really motivated me to realize, like, if the women especially don't need to be good to get the benefits of this. And for most of us, it was really motivating them to stay sober or, like, not go back to that abusive relationship or, you know, want to try to be a part of society again. If they didn't have to be good to want to do these things, like, you know, that was crazy. But I also knew a ton of women where I lived in Sacramento that I'm sure they could be as good as this team, like, if they wanted it. And what a great opportunity for someone who doesn't feel like they have anything going for them to travel to another country, to be a part of a team. So after that event, when I got back home, it was like, you know, I'm going to see if these women want to have it, if we can get enough women to get a team together. And when I got back, like, people were really excited for me. I got really a lot of positive attention. And then my people that I lived with, the peers that I lived with, also saw something different in me. Like, I was very hopeful and kind of fit my personality and my life experiences really well. Like, I was really excited about recovery and sobriety, but also soccer was, like, in my blood. Like, it is who I am. So this was, like, a perfect space for me to kind of function. And if I could teach these women to play soccer, like, I could definitely teach, like, the people that I lived with to play. And so that was kind of what we did. And it worked well because a lot of the women I was living with, they have their kids. So they were kind of stuck sometimes at the transitional living community. And so they didn't have anything to do. So we're like, all right, we'll just have a practice like in the parking lot. I have a ball. I don't have a car. I didn't have anything. And you're like, we'll just see if they show up. And they started showing up and they bring like all of their kids. So we're like, all right, like, let's just like, we had four or five ladies who had nothing else to do. They were looking for something to do. And I told them, like, if you guys show up, I will find a way to take you to the next National Cup. And they showed up. And we were like, all right, like, we've got a fundraise now. So that was kind of like our first team. But, you know, even our first women's team, there wasn't a ton of interest. But there were some women who... And, you know, it was funny. They were so bad that we had such a good time. Because laughing is just like... They can't tell you how many soccer, like, they missed everything. They couldn't even, like, you know, trying to dribble a ball. It was, like, it was so funny. But also for them, it was so hard for them to control the ball that they had to concentrate so much when we played that they didn't think about anything else. Like, they weren't thinking about the other stuff that was going wrong in their lives. So it was kind of a break for them, too. But there was a couple women who brought their kids out as well, and they had strained relationships, and we didn't have anybody to scrimmage against. So then we'd, like, scrimmage their kids. And they were really good. So, like, the kids are, like, practicing against us. And, you know, they're pissed at their moms for the decisions that they've made. So they're just, like, scoring and, like, feel so good about it. Just, like, so there was, like, some interesting things that happened in our first team. But that was, you know, that was 6 or 7 years ago. And that was kind of how we built it out. We worked with a lot of women in domestic violence, a lot of women in sobriety or recovery, mental illness sometimes. But what we really tried to connect them with was a place of relief, a place of having fun. And then when we'd have practices, our organization has, like, some life skills that we facilitate during practices. So, like, one skill might be show up. And we'll talk about the importance of showing up for your team or for a game and what that means. And then they'll understand it in the team context. And then we say, how does that look like in your life? Like, what did you show up for today that you're proud of? Or what did you show up today that was hard that you're glad you showed up for? You know, or it's like, we have another one that's called Build Your Triangle. If you guys see the games out here, you'll see that the triangle is the offensive shape that you want to have in this game. And so that means you're constantly supported by another teammate. If you have the ball, you know that there's people there for you. And so we, you know, experience that on the field. And then off the field, you know, what does your triangle look like off the field? Do you have that support on each side? Are you that support system for somebody else? And it makes it much easier for them to process and then apply it. And so those are some of the things that we worked with. And then just real quick, I think we're almost at time. Yeah? Oh, okay. I know that there's other countries that we've spoken with that have a hard time with the women's program and getting women engaged. And we're not super huge. We usually have a 10 to 12 women we work pretty closely with every year. But 90% of them have stayed sober. And I don't know if you're familiar with the sobriety, like, success rate. In the United States, it's like 1 to 10. And when I was in rehab, they're like 1 out of 10 who's going to make it. And there's 20 of us looking at each other like, who's it going to be? Like, it's like, if 18 of you are gone tomorrow, does that better my chances? So that was interesting. And then the other thing with the women's program that we found pretty insightful, and just we had to work really hard to make that space for women. we had a men's street soccer team in that same site, and that was hard for them to respect the space for women. Like, there was just, and I don't think it was ill-intended, but they didn't understand, like, why that space needed to be for women. And a lot of the women we were playing with were so, so bad, not in a negative way, but they just were not skilled and they weren't athletic. So if guys came in that were really good, it intimidated them. And then also a lot of women we worked with had, like, domestic violence issues, so they didn't want to be around men in a physical way yet. So kind of having that space just for the women, it let them learn the game at their own pace, feel free, like, they became comfortable being bad at it, which was a good thing, because then they kind of let go of being perfect, and now it's just, let's just work. If I keep dribbling, I'll get better. If I keep shooting, I'll get better. We had a girl who missed, like, so many shots in one tournament, like, you couldn't have given her a nicer soccer ball to just, like, kick, and then just, like, swing and a miss. And I'm like, oh, my God, like, just keep shooting. Like, that was, like, we're, like, just keep trying. And then finally, like, she made one, and it was, like, you know, it's so exciting. That's, like, the process. And she's actually, she's doing really well. She played in the Homeless World Cup. She's actually coming out here on Friday, but she's featured in one of the, in the program. Her name's Angie. So if you guys look in the program, you'll see, like, a United States player, and that was her. Terrible soccer player. She's doing really good now, though. Like, she's like a professional personal trainer. Like, just, she found her niche. But the other thing with the women was, and I saw this in rehab. I think it's natural. I don't think it's just in sports, but most of the women that when I went to rehab, the first thing they said was how much they hated other women, and were pretty much unwilling to work with them. And I found this interesting because we have all lost everything in our lives. It's like all of us are coming to the table with nothing but regret and mistakes. And they're still willing to hold on to this idea of I'm not going to trust you. And these are all the women who, this is the only community we have right now that is similar interests, trying to stay sober. And then I realized that was their reaction because they had never played in any kind of team sports with other women. It was really normal for me to have people on my team that I didn't like, but, like, it didn't matter. Like, we just figured it out. So that was a new concept. When we went to the transitional living, a lot of the women had a conflict, too. And the only way we were able to resolve it in the beginning was because you have to have 4 players for a team. So if they wanted to go on this trip, we needed to have at least 4 or 5 players. So they were like, all right, like, fine. And they were so bad that, like, not one of the players could do everything by themselves. So they had to figure out, like, how do we work together to, like, score a goal? Because everyone's goal-oriented, right? So you, and women are competitive, and they want to win. So it's like you put them in this space, and, like, now they want to win. They don't like each other, but they want to win. And we had some women who, like, had no friends, but she was willing to play goalie. Nobody else wanted to play goalie. So, like, all right, like, you can come. and that was, like, their own health barriers were kind of what forced them to work together. And after 6 months to 12 months of practicing, they became, like, best friends. And it was because they grew respect for each other. And it's interesting, as some of the women communicated how much they may have disliked another one of the women, when they played, they supported them. Like, they never left them on their own. So their actions on the court were very different sometimes than what they communicated verbally. And that we found that to be true a lot of times. Like, we could learn a lot from them by watching them play, because that was more true to who they were than what they were living in their own lives. But, you know, that was how we started it. And we've had a team every year for the last, since 2010. We've sent, I think, at least 1 or 2 players from Sacramento every year to the Homeless World Cup. It's become really like a leadership kind of development program. But the intention is not to build a soccer player. It's for them to be more empowered to go after what their dreams are or their goals. Some of these women have been combating, you know, or have been in crisis mode for so long, they haven't thought about a goal and they haven't thought about a dream. And it takes a little while to develop. Like, 90 days into rehab isn't usually enough. So we find that a lot of the women will stick around for 1 to 3 years until they really get kind of decide what they want to do, and then they have the skills to go after that. But yeah, that's kind of been our experience, and so far it's been really amazing. We always love coming out here and take a lot of pride in making that space for women, because it's not easy, but we have to really intentionally create it and then find ways to sell it, not sell it, but make it of interest to them, and then provide that space. You know, this is a great event where skill level is not the priority. And what we see, it's like when the women come back from this tournament especially, they're a different person when they go back home. Like something has clicked. And you can't buy that kind of response. We haven't seen that happen in like a rehab program and things like that. So it's kind of then they go back and, you know, they're leaders in our community, and they want to go let everybody else know like what can be achieved as a woman, what can be achieved when they get out of those bad situations. We have a player this year who's actually, she's a daughter of one of our very first players. And she's one of the kids that we played against that, like, and, you know, she's doing great. And this is another opportunity for her that they wouldn't normally have. So I think that's, yeah.
So we want to finish there?
Yeah. If you guys have any questions, if I missed something, you know, please ask her. I'm sure I was all over the place, but...
No, it is fantastic.
Yeah.
It's so nice and interesting to hear you speak about your experiences. And I'm sure somebody has a few questions.
Or I have.
Oh.
Any questions? Are you so overwhelmed?
Yeah. Hey.
Thank you for the speech. I think you're a great inspiration for people playing street soccer, and it's a lot of parallels for stories like Mette and her wife started also a similar team, so mm-hmm. it's recognizable, and I think it's very interesting how you, who has also, it's been a lot of talk today about vulnerable groups, marginalization, about us and them. But here an example that also having a background yourself can be like a real advantage in your work. Can you say something about the challenges and opportunities of having this background yourself when working with the team?
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. We found like there's a ton of stigma, and I think, I don't know, again, like I don't know how it is here, but there's a ton of stigma in the United States about just making mistakes and failing. Addiction, crimes, like, you know, it's sort of, the perspective is like, once you've made a mistake, you can't come back from that. And I think the disadvantage of that is there's people with a lot of experience who, you know, once they sort of resolve and become more reliable, that's how we reach those other people. But it's a huge asset to our community to have people overcoming the adversity, because also those are the strongest people that we have. Like, I've met many men and women, and they're so strong and they're so tough that if they can just get on the right track, they're going to be unstoppable. But they're also fearless because it's kind of like, I have this one woman who, I don't know why, she was afraid of flying. But she also was a sex worker for like years, and drug user, and in domestic violence situations. And like, you're afraid of flying? Like, how is that? I don't understand. Like, you've survived so many life-threatening situations. But you know, she works with women on a daily basis, talking them through mental illness. And also, it's important for people to be able to relate to the success story. So when I can say that I've been in jail, or I've been hopeless, or I know what that feels like, then they believe me a little more about the success. So it's hard for somebody who's not happy to relate to somebody who is happy until we can start connecting with them. And you're like, dude, I've been there. I've done this. Like, I have to tell people now that I've been in jail, and they're like, no, I don't believe you. But yeah, it's super important, because I think when these people recover, they're the greatest asset. They have so much to offer. They're willing to work with others, but also, like, they're tough. I've worked with some people who, like, they cry over a negative email, and you're like, we have work to do. Like, I need you, like, you know, like, we got, or working as a team. Like, that's such a foreign thing. And so when you have people who are tough, and they've got grit, and they're resilient, and they're willing to give, and they're committed to giving back, like, that's, we need that in our community. And those are the people who reach and inspire those who need it the most, I think. But yeah, definitely. Yep.
Yes, I just want to thank you for sharing your life with us. You know, I work with people who use methadone, amphetamine, and every other kind of pills. it helped me understand why they react the way they do. Like when all of a sudden they start telling me that I'm useless, and we believe that we are boosting every time and so on. So it helped me understand really what they are going through in their heart. It's a very strange word. No, it's an unknown word for us to work with them. So my question to you is this. I've heard that to be able to be sober, you've got to find some other drug which can replace the drug you are addicted to. And soccer can be that. But unfortunately, I've seen some who overnight give up.
Mm.
Do you have some tip as to what they can do to hold on until the end?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've used soccer as a drug before, too. And it lasts for so long. For me, and where we've seen a lot of success, is with the individuals committed to, like, a program, whether it's, like, AA or NA. And then soccer is a bit of the supplement because there's some internal things that need to get worked out for somebody who's been using drugs and numbing themselves for so long. I think soccer is a good reminder of what can, you know, it's a flash of being happy. And I think sometimes those little flashes are hope. That's kind of where we have enough relief to think about or to work through what we want. But I don't think that soccer alone would treat a drug addict or alcoholic. I think it needs to go with, you know, another kind of program. We haven't had any success with soccer being the sole sort of solution for a real drug addict or alcoholic. It's got to be another program, but we've been able to use that as an incentive. You know, like if somebody's struggling with it and they come to a practice, they meet some other women who have done the program and can kind of like, hey, like I'll take you to a meeting. Or we kind of like come to a practice and then meet some people. But if you want to be on the team, like they've got to be growing also in another way. So every week we'll do a check-in and it's like, okay, what'd you accomplish this week? Like what's going well for you? And the people who are really moving forward, they'll have something to talk about. But if somebody's only using soccer, they're either not going to want to share or they're not going to have anything to say. But we focus more on the personal development. And so I think with, like, true alcoholics and drug addicts, like, there's got to be some other kind of, you know, rehabilitation or program that they're working.
Yeah. Other questions?
No?
I like a lot when you're using the metaphor of the game, mm-hmm. and you're relating it to the real life. That when you're defending, somebody's supporting you there. When you're on your own with the ball, who will play with you? So I think that's a good way of using the game
mm-hmm.
as a metaphor for the life, the general life.
Yeah, it's really become the soccer is the facilitator, the lessons. It helps us to. Arrive at the lessons that they need to leave with and apply in their lives.
And I know that some of the street soccer players in Norway also said that actually playing, when you say what they're doing in the field is more true than what they are saying verbally.
Mm-hmm.
They say also this is it's a common language. It's a soccer language.
Yeah.
You're there, you're doing things with other people. The bodies are doing things. And you're communicating. You don't have to use the words, maybe. So that's also accomplishing something.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
On another level. You don't have to be verbal in order to succeed, maybe, if you're not.
Yeah, I think, too, you know, you can show some... Even if communication is still important, because, you know, being verbal, I think, is helpful, but it's like you can show up for somebody by facing them. Like if I'm facing you, then you know that I'm being supportive. If my back is to you, it might not look so supportive. Like if the person who has the ball and everybody else turns their back to them, it's not like they're gonna feel real good about that. You know, it's like,
well, that's exactly what I mean. Because
yeah.
This is another kind of, it's a non-verbal language.
Yeah, yeah.
But it speaks a lot.
Yeah. There's lots of ways of communicating, and that's a good thing to bring up to people who haven't been good communicators.
Yeah.
Like, maybe they don't know it when they're with their kids that they're backs to them all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you're like, you know, if so-and-so felt this way, like, how do you think your kids feel? Like, oh, okay.
And some players also said, I didn't know that I was a sociable person. They just realized meeting the team that I'm actually quite good at this. I'm good at relating to people.
Yeah.
But they hadn't, So.
There's a lot of people who are like socially awkward, especially like drug addicts, and like that's why we use drugs and drink. It's just like we're not good with people, but I can make friends on a soccer field in a second. Like, but like if I have to meet you and like do a handshake, like it's gonna get awkward. Like it's gonna get weird. I'm gonna say something weird, and then I'm gonna feel weird about it, and then so I think for it, you know, it is a good place for that to happen. Definitely, yeah. Cool. Good.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Oh, cool. There's a bag from this university.
Awesome. Thank you. Very cool. Yeah, you guys should go out and watch the games if you want.
When are you playing next?
Oh, we actually play in like 30 minutes or like 3:20.
Oh yeah, that's why they left the
other job. Yeah. But I don't know what our games are, but we're not really doing that well, but they're like they have fun.
Thank you so much. Okay, let's start again. The next speaker is Elisabeth Klosser. She's a PhD candidate and at the Institute of Health and Society at the University of Oslo, and she's also a social anthropologist, medical anthropologist, and her title is Life Experience as Competence, also as a Volunteer.
Yeah, for competence in voluntary work, actually, yes.
Yeah, or competence in voluntary work, yeah.
Yeah, that's it.
So welcome, and the floor is yours.
Yeah, so I'm not going to get into the details of the title. I also work at the Church State Mission, and I was thinking, inspired by Lisa, who just spoke, I've also worked as a manager at a project called Safid, which I thought I would use today. So Safid is a networking center for people with a drug user background, people long-term drug use, attempting to establish themselves with new and different routines, and preferably in a sort of life after rehabilitation. My PhD was inspired by the fact that I had worked at this center, and so it's along the same theme. And it's I did a lot of participant observation and interviews in 2012, and then I've been working back and forth between the City Mission and my PhD, and I'm going to start this autumn again. This is sort of a good way of getting going with the material once more. Anyway, I just thought I would say that what Lisa was talking about inspired me in terms of when I began my PhD work, which was with long-term or intermittent drug users that were now sober. When I talked to people about the project, I found that quite a few would respond automatically by saying, wow, can a drug user volunteer? They never caught on to the fact that I was in fact speaking of sober people or people that were not necessarily in their active use, but it was something about the mindset of thinking that, a drug user, once a drug user, always a drug user. Or like a social medicine professor that I talked to, when I talked about the project, he said, why can't people just be drug users alone as far as sort of the goodwill of volunteers? So what he heard was that there were volunteers in the sense of resourceful people that were going to help the drug users. None of them caught on to the fact that I was, in fact, my study was going to be volunteering by long-term drug users, and most of them then sober. And it brought me to think that, in a sense, the people that I was talking about was almost a kind of conundrum. At once, an active agent, because in Norwegian, volunteer is free and willing. And on the other hand, a passive recipient, someone who uses, someone who is slave to the drugs, dependent, hooked, driven, a completely other kind of person. So that was why I thought this was really an exciting thing to sort of start looking closer at what is it? What are the thresholds? And one thing is the theory, but what is the practice? what are the cultural and social practices that we have in volunteering. Anyway, so that was, I just felt that she was sort of touching on that same idea when she was talking about her own experience, and it's very inspiring to see someone who can just be so obviously active and participating and resourceful with that background. Because it's the people that I meet all the time, but it's always a good reminder. I thought I would say something as far as my sort of PhD background, because I was at the opening day of the World Homeless World Cup on Tuesday, and I was at the... you can't see it there because it's a really rotten picture, but it's a picture of women playing Norway Chile on Tuesday. And we talked a lot about the players, but there are also a lot of volunteers. For this game, I saw that they were recruiting 350 volunteers. And in Norway, as in many of the Nordic countries, then volunteering is valued as meaningful and as socially valuable. There's a broad and long tradition for volunteering. A majority of the people, men, women, young, older, participate. In 2015, 61% reported that they had done something voluntarily the last year. That's just sort of one number. And it's on several fields, within culture, politics, sports, social welfare. It's a broad range. And historically, the voluntary organizations have been arenas for political participation, for creating national identity. And so it's a part of the sense that people grow up in and participate in the volunteering, and in it also reflects the way we think of sameness and difference as citizens of Norway. And so a volunteer can be anyone from someone, a clerk at the Homeless World Cup, someone who's helping someone come in. It can be a rescue worker, it can be a woman knitting socks, or a man knitting socks for the organizations helping out people, or selling hot dogs. So there's a whole broad range, but it's socially valued. And so being able to say that you're a volunteer is also a good thing. And in recent 20 to 30 years, we haven't really had, before that, we haven't really talked about volunteering, but it came on the agenda. And it's also a part of a political response that in Norway and Nordic countries, that we need the voluntary involvement to maintain our welfare state. Also seeing that through voluntary involvement, it contributes to building trust between people, people gain networks, we contribute, we get acknowledgement, we take part, we work in teams. It has a lot of positive qualities to it. So in 2005, for example, one of the white papers said volunteerism for everyone. So it's been a real sort of trying to find out how you can involve also people that are less likely to be involved in volunteering. And as a result of that, or in that process, the Norwegian government has supported more than 400 volunteer centers nationally since 1990. And with the idea of being a meeting place for people of all kinds of people, employed, unemployed, wherever you are in life, taking part in your local community. So with that, I worked as a manager at a volunteer center that was established in 2002. And I thought I would now change, because no one is only what you see. So I would go from sort of, that's just the background. My PhD work is sort of the background of the experience that I had through a center called Safir, which is in Oslo. It is downtown in Grønland. And I thought I would say a little bit about the experiences that we had when we established the place, because that's sometimes useful. So this house, it's a beautiful house. It was established 15 years ago. Not this house was established 15 years ago, but 15 years ago, this volunteer center I was asked if I would want to start a volunteer center with a focus on people with a drug use background. And I thought that would be interesting. It was a volunteer center. And we started. I had a very traditional idea of who a volunteer was. So we recruited through the Red Cross and the City Mission and lots of people that had lots of good normal experience. And the only problem was that none of the potential users ever came. And that only served to what people would say, they never come, they never arrive, they never turn up. We had all kinds of activities and people just didn't arrive. So what we did was I invited in a group of men and women that were in methadone-assisted rehabilitation and asked them, so what do you think, what should we do to make this into something that could work for people? And what initially, it was a place where we said people could be sober or not. It was open. The volunteers were there to sort of assist people to, if there were things they wanted to solve in their lives. And what they said was, you know, everyone else, once we thought we were, I had this dream when I came into the methadone program that I would be considered drug-free when I came out, or sober when I came out of the program. But there's no one in the system that believes that we're going to be sober. So no one takes it seriously. All the places we come to, it's a mix of people buying, selling, or using drugs or not using drugs. What we need is a place that we can have as a sober place, a meeting place. And so that's what we said, well, we'll try that. And once we got them involved, they said, and also, we cannot be in this basement. It was a sort of a dark, damp basement. You had to walk down the stairs to get in. And the rest of the house was a house with poor women that lived in it that had a double diagnosis. So it was a problematic house in any case. Like, this is not going to change our lives. And then we found this house. And the house has beautiful stairs up, and you can really walk up and into it. It wasn't rehabilitated when we came to it. People started painting the fence. People got involved. Suddenly, there were lots of people coming, and it was a volunteer center. People were involved. People could talk about what the house was going to be, and those who had practical experience or didn't, anyone could paint the fence. And once we moved into the house, the participants, we also went from saying, we're not going to say users, we're going to say participants. So it was participants. Once we came to the house, participants said, well, we should get to know our neighbors. And I have to say that one of the competencies that really our participants had at that point was to see our neighbors, and they have had a very open eye to, this is a neighborhood with a lot of vulnerable social groups. Not speaking of themselves, but at Greenland, there are a lot of vulnerable social groups. So they said, we will invite the elderly. And so we had a neighbor party that everyone without picking up came with wheelchairs, rolling in elderly people that had no idea what they were coming to, but a barbecue and music and everything in the back. And also in this house, because we couldn't afford to be alone in the house, we couldn't afford the whole house, we ended up sharing it with a project for single parents. And so it was also a place where vulnerable mums with their kids had gatherings with volunteers, not at the same time that we had our official program. We would share it during the week, but it was definitely a kind of a sharing house, and we were breaking some real barriers. We were saying, initially, you know, the ones when we were going to establish it, they're like, but how can you have drug users with children? And how, you know, just sort of to keep challenging the associations that people had to this. And it has, today they are still in the same house, and it has worked very well. Different people come and different people. It's a very lively house. So then I wanted to say something about one of the projects that we had, and after we'd sort of settled into the house, because I have said that this monologue is about sort of competence and experience. And in that initial phase, when we moved into the house, we came across a project in Glasgow that had a housing project where also homeless, with different issues, worked with making courses and using their own competence and experience as a part of the courses. So we were attached to them, and we said, well, we'll try making a housing school here as well. And when Lisa was talking, I realized that I recognized a lot of this chaotic thing. So we got funding to go, a whole group to Glasgow and travel. Unfortunately, we didn't have any games, so we had variable experiences. Most of it went really, really well. And for others, it was more challenging to be in a different city. But on the whole, it was a really good story and a lot of good experience. And also, people came over from Glasgow to us. The principle behind this is that, and also again, like Lisa was saying, that the experience that you've been there yourself and you can be a role model is something that is valuable for both the people that come in as new participants. It's valuable for the person doing it. It's a gradual process. So the courses, the way the housing school was set up, was that every semester there would be a group that could be interested in being a volunteer. There was also a volunteer who didn't have any of the personal experience of being a drug user, who could sort of come into the group and facilitate and fill in the rest practical things or whatever was not working or was needed. And then the group would sit together and talk about issues that could be interesting to have a course. And it could be anything. It could be how to tackle Christmas, or how to go find an apartment, how to set up a budget, or how to cook. But the issues or the themes of the courses would always come from the group themselves. And again, typically, if you have a course like that, then or a day, that they would be one-day courses, or one-afternoon courses, you would think, oh, let me get an expert from somewhere out there who can come and tell them how to do it. But the principle at the housing school was that it would always be someone in the group who had had something to say on the topic, someone who had either experienced it or who had... had a wish to learn something about it, had talked about the challenges of it, and then sometimes you'd get other resources in, but they were always the one who sort of owned the theme of that day. And it is really magical, because I'm thinking, sometimes if I feel uncomfortable because I assume that someone assumes something about me, it makes you feel like an outsider, and it's very difficult to be involved in something. But if you see someone that you recognize, that you feel comfortable with, and that you can relate to, it's always easier. And once you've gotten over that threshold, you're just much more prone to listen in. It's easier to ask the questions, and it's also easier to take in the information that you're getting and trust it. And that's a lot of what Lisa was saying too. You know, it's just you have to trust where it's coming from. And for a happy person to speak to an unhappy person, it's just it's two different places to be in the world. So the housing school still exists, it's just sort of one example of how you can use the experience as a way of also room for reflection. Because the way it worked would be that if one of the participants could start, and maybe the biggest challenge would be to make coffee for the next course, you know, and even if you made coffee for yourself at home, there's suddenly a difference. You're going to make it for 20 or 30 people. Like, it was saying, how many spoons you put in, when do I switch it on, is it going to get cold, are we going to have enough thermoses, how do I cut up the fruit. So they would help each other, and very often, and in varying degrees, those people would start to welcome the people coming for the day. Sometimes present the rules in the room, like no questions are dumb, switch off your mobiles. So there was a whole way of developing that, which they still practice. But what I wanted to say was that this was something that got a lot of attention, and people were like, oh, it's so successful, it's so easy, you know, this is the way to do it. And it's not that easy, because I think there are also a lot of challenges. So I'm seeing that, you know, some people would come and you can do, it has to be something that you feel that you can manage, and something that you can do step by step. And you have to be able to do it in your own pace. This one person especially was always telling me, you know, don't push me. I have to do this in my own pace. So me thinking, well, this is very easy, it can be linear, but that's not the way it works. Because there are so many other, this was a small supplement in people's lives. This was one place that people were, But there were other things going on in people's lives. And it wasn't necessarily the case that everything was okay. They could have difficult sort of economic situations. They had family relations. They had network problems. They had housing problems. You had a lot of sort of a lot of stuff, luggage with you, and as what you had done or what you'd lived in or what you'd missed or how you'd failed. And all of this sometimes just builds up. And even if this center and your responsibility here is an important part of your life, it's not necessarily something that you're always going to be able to prioritize. Sometimes you just can't do it and you disappear. And I think in one sense an advantage of having a place like this was that time was not measured. People could be associated with it for as long as they wanted to. You could also be gone for a while, and no one would really ask you what you had done unless you offered that information, because you could really try to be yourself. That was our thought, was that you could be yourself, the best of yourself when you want to be there. And so if you feel that, you know, if that's the way you want to do it, then you can balance your life and it's your choice. But the constant... and I think also Greta, was that her name? She was talking about the program, the training, her PhD, where she said she had to stand next to people all the time and be supportive, you know, and pick it up. It's just that constant sort of being there, but always feeling how much you have to be there, and you're not really, you know, do I push, do I pull, do I just leave alone? So it's not an easy thing, but I think in sum that the experience that I had was that you have to see this as a sort of a collective development, in the sense that if it's a strong community sense, not everyone will be involved in it, but if the sum is positive, then, you know, people may go out for a while and maybe come in, but if the sum is positive, if it's a good story, then it's one of several stories that people have. You have to use other arenas, do other stuff, but at least if you have something that makes you happy, sort of like the soccer team, something that makes you happy or that can make you feel good, then why not do it? What I was going to also is that this was a volunteer center, and we tried to maintain it as that. It's very easy to think that it was that it's closer up to a treatment facility, or it would be easy to make that connection. And we found that a lot of people that came to Sophia, and that still do, you after rehabilitation, they usually will tell you that, you know, you have to just quit your friends, quit your past life, just start anew. And that's extremely challenging. But this had to be a place where you could go voluntarily, where really no one was forcing you to go there. But it's something that you can be pleased with yourself for having done when you go to it. And I think that within... another thing was I, as a part of my PhD project, I was concerned with also, do people really... I asked the participants if it was important for the ones that actually were volunteering, was it important to be a volunteer? And they're like... And I thought, I always thought it was. No, because being a volunteer, I actually don't necessarily feel like I'm a volunteer because I had too many issues. It doesn't correspond with the general sense of what a volunteer should be. But it's really important for me to do the participation and the volunteering, to be expected, to be trusted, to be relied upon. Which is maybe the, sort of the biggest thing, that someone is relying on me to come, or someone is relying on me at least to give a message if I don't come. And that's also, I think, part of the whole, you know, in a work situation, it's all structured. In a treatment facilitation, there's, you know, there's the guidelines and the risk and everything that you have to do. Whereas in much of the voluntary sector, there are very few regulations. It's a sum of everyone, what you do together. There's a flexibility there. And not only that, but people come there with the time they have. So it's not as if you're going to be that different if you suddenly disappear 3 weeks. a retired person, a pensioner could go, you know, I have some time on my hands. I'm going to Spain for a month. I'll be back next month. So it's not as obvious that your life is less regular. One of the disadvantages is that it's not maybe more regular, but and some people would love to be there every day, every week, and sort of have that as a lifestyle, and that's not always possible. But it's also you can use it at will. And also this aspect of having experience. I mean, I said life experience as a competence. Everyone has life experience. But I think that's a part of also a context like that, where you meet people with different life experiences. And oftentimes, people would say, well, you know, initially kind of like you think that normal people, they're like something completely different. Or normal people would say, drug use is something completely different. Whereas when you are together in a sense of that volunteering and participation, you realize that people have their challenges. You have them wherever you are in life. You know, there are people are and I, one of the first things when we moved into the house, I remember one of the volunteers like she was actually not working. She had burned the muscles in her arm and was unable to, and she had mice in her basement. And two of the guys, participants, long-term drug users in the past, like, we'll get the mice. And they went home to her house. And I didn't really, you know, it made a lot of sense in the setting. And then someone else said, they went home to her house and got the mice. and so, you know, and that's, we all have our challenges. And I think just being constantly reminded that there are no one's only what you see, you know. There's just we're much more than that one label, and to have that the stigma she's talking about, you know, this total identity that Goffman speaks of, that it's just sort of you assume that you know everything about a person just because you can call them, you can label them for something. It's just so much more fun to remove the labels. So. Anybody has to use my time. I don't know when I started, actually.
Yeah, I'm not so sure.
Anyway,
I think you are right on time.
Yeah, I think we should round up here. Yeah. So this is a long, but this is sort of the ideal one person, and this is not at Sahib, but he. This was a part of my initial material for my PhD. And he had a background as a volunteer, and he was just sort of drawing up the line for himself. And I think it was sort of a very sort of optimistic way of seeing it. The challenge of returning to a normal life is not just about how the surroundings see you, but also about how you see yourself. The key is time. After some time, you create new points of reference, and your background becomes less interesting. After 3 years in the cycling group, he was a leader of the cycling group. Some may say that I'm a good leader. The background is gradually erased and becomes less interesting. Finally, you're a good leader, but with a special gift for communicating with participants who have a drug user or criminal background. How an acquired this competence, I think, hopefully becomes less interesting.
Have the time for one question. I think we started a little bit late.
We did start late. Very late, actually.
Yeah, yeah. So, any questions for Elisabeth? Or comments?
No?
But I think it's very interesting what also Lisa and you said about labeling people, and it sticks with you, which is a very, very stigmatizing society if we keep going in that direction. Yeah, which is really, really just exhausting people and not giving them a new chance.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
So. But thank you very much for sharing your knowledge.
We will go on to Paloma Leon. She is a consultant at a place called Batteria, which is a care for self organization run by the Czech City Mission now also. And she will talk about empowerment as an opening door to participation in society.
and about social inequality and about building identity. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation. As mentioned, my name is Paloma. I work in a center called Batteria. And I'm very glad to be here today, and I'm also very glad for the way this day started. Because we started with a dialogue with people in a really nice way. Because that's, I think, one of the key questions. How do you get to people? How do you get to know them, and how can you learn from people? And I just want to ask you, how many of you are students here today? So most of you are students. And you study social work. What else?
Physiotherapy.
Something else? Mostly physiotherapy? Mm-hmm. Okay. I don't know much about that. I studied myself sociology and pedagogy. But I think it's something that somebody mentioned it early today, that it's interesting to connect knowledge from different points of view. How is pedagogy connected with social work? How is social work connected with your studies and so on? So I think we have to think about in a holistic way to actually understand how to get to people. Because that's why you're studying what you're studying. And that's why many people are here today. So I'm going to talk about not marginalization as such, but I'm going to talk about empowerment in order to understand marginalization and what empowerment really is. As mentioned, I work in a center. Well, first, I'm going to divide this short presentation in three parts. The first part, I'm going to talk about who we are, who is Batteria, and what is Batteria, what we do. Second part, empowerment as a theoretical framework, just to really understand the concept. And third of all, empowerment in practice. How do we operate with that concept in real life? And I think that's one of the most important things to mention. So Batteria is part of Kirkes Bymisjon, or Church City Mission. We are a center for self-organization and self-help, which means that we guide and work with organizations and grassroots organizations in Norway, but especially in topics such as poverty and social exclusion. The center was established in 2003 in Oslo, and right now we have 5 centers around the country. And as mentioned, we work with different type of grassroots organizations that can be previous drug addictors that have been organized in, for example, different organizations in Norway. We were working with immigrants, with women, with a vast of many different organizations and people that are trying to organize and to do something about their marginalized life. And as mentioned, empowerment is one of our theoretical tools or frameworks in our work and our values as Batteria. So I'm just going to explain what we understand with empowerment. And there are many different ways to understand empowerment. You can understand empowerment as an individual growth. You are eager to achieve success. To achieve self-acceptance, and it's about your individual growth in a way. But in our case, in Batteria, we work with a more broader concept of empowerment, which in this case I call social empowerment, which means that it's a process you do, but it's also an outcome. But you can't do it alone. You have to do it with your group, with the people you are surrounded in, with your community. So that's why this example was also really interesting. What's her name?
Lisa.
Yeah. And also that social empowerment is also about social change. So in order for you to be empowered, you need to change your society in a way. You need to change your situation. But you can't do it alone. You have to do it in your community and with your people. So we're talking about a lot of social awareness about your situation. And Bateria, it's quite inspired by a guy, you can say that, called Paulo Freire. I don't know if you have heard about him. He was an educator from Brazil, and he worked a lot with farmers and in Brazil during the 60s. And it was interesting because he started to understand empowerment in a really interesting way, because he saw that the farmers in Brazil, they were kind of living in what he calls a silent culture, you know, which means that it's a culture where you are marginalized, but you understand marginalization as a natural way of living. So you're not actually questioning marginalization. You're just part of it, and that's totally natural. So for him, it was very important to actually question himself, how can you actually break with this culture of silence? Is it possible? Is it possible that peasants, teachers, students, and so on in Brazil could get a social awareness that they are living in a cultural silence? And for him, there were especially two big challenges concerning this. The first thing is that people who were living in cultural silence in Brazil, they were meeting a lot of poverty, and especially material poverty. But, and most importantly, that people who were marginalized could also reproduce structure of power. And that was, you can mention one example, and that's, for example, gender relations, where you marginalize and you reproduce power at your home, or between teachers and students, for instance. So for him, the challenge was to how to break that. How can you think and operate differently? So for him, there were two concepts in Freire's philosophy, and that's praxis and dialogue. So for him, one way to empower people was through praxis and dialogue, which means that you have to think, you have to reflect, but you also need to act to change your environment. So his method, Freire's method, was to how can we give voice to the voiceless? And for him, praxis was one method where you actually reflect. You think about your environment, you think about the situation you're within, but you also act, you change something in your community, at the community. But he also says that dialogue is very important. How can you get to people by having a dialogue that actually communicates with people, that not, you know, tries to reinforce one way of thinking, but you actually get to know each other, but you learn with your community. And that requires a lot of humbleness, that I'm not the one who owns knowledge, but I'm learning with you, participating with you. But it requires also a lot of hope. Hope that you actually believe that people can change. And that's not easy. So dialogue for him is not about only transferring information, as maybe I'm doing now, you know? I'm transferring you information about Paulo Freire, and, you know? It's more about how you actually can change something with that information. It's about what kind of experience do you have that is important for me as well. So it's a, what can you say, a dialectic dialogue. It's not something imposed, and it's not a transferation of ideas. So it's a bit complex, but I think it's quite interesting and also very interesting for our work in Bateria. So I will just challenge you now, so you can actually talk with each other. And then my question is, will you find cultural of silence in Norway or at your community? Or is this just over and out? No? So please. please, two and two, the one you have right to you or beside you, just talk to you. 2 minutes, talk to each other. Can we actually find the cultural of silence in your at your community, in your community? And what kind of cultural of silence do you find? Do you have something?
Come on. In all the different professions, you have a culture of silence.
So professions?
If I interpreted it, my way of interpreting it is like, culture of silence and knowledge that is not speaking,
mm-hmm.
speaking and spoken. For example, if I communicate with a coach,
mm-hmm.
we can say stuff and we don't need words sometimes, we understand exactly each other.
Mm-hmm.
But if I say the same thing to another professionalist, it's different.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, but that's my interpretation of your
mm-hmm.
culture of silence.
So you can actually, through culture of silence, exclude somebody else.
The way is to do this that you say that we need to, if you want to build social empowerment, we need to communicate with that thing that doesn't feel familiar.
Mm-hmm.
And you realize that you have a lot in common.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes a culture of the community.
Yeah. Your own culture. Yeah, interesting. Yeah. Somebody else?
Mm-hmm. Oh, we were just thinking about because we spoke earlier today about the prison, and Tom said that you couldn't cry in the prison.
You couldn't
cry
mm-hmm.
or show weakness.
Yeah.
So that's another way of that language is not. There is no room for this kind of language in this culture.
Mm-hmm.
So that also may be a culture of silence within a prison.
Yeah. And that culture also, in a way, in that particular case, it's also oppressing you, your feelings,
yeah.
in one way. So in a culture of silence, you might find solidarity with the people you know and you actually share something with. But you can also find power of relations, you know, where you can feel that something, you don't know what, is also oppressing you somehow. Feelings, for example. Boys or guys are not meant to cry, right? Especially not in prison. That's one very good example. What else? Is that it? So we don't have silence of cultural silence in Norway. Yeah?
it's not so easy to see your own black spots or we are a bit culturally blind, I think.
Yeah, maybe. Can we find cultural silence in a classroom, for example? Maybe. Well, Paulo Freire maybe might say yes, because there are structure of power between the ones who teaches and the ones who receive information, where there are no, some cases there are dialogue, but some cases there are no dialogue. So for him, there will be absolutely structure of power also in the classroom. So for him, the main idea of education is how to learn from each other, and also what you do with that knowledge, how you transform or change something outside the classroom. So just to go forward, what you call that in English, I'm not sure, but batterie effecten, that's something we work with, batterie. And for us, empowerment is about a down-up approach, which means that we connect and we are with the people, with the organizations that we work with. So our way of seeing people is as agents for change, with the ability to create own knowledge and solutions. And that's very different from a more paternalistic way of seeing people. Because that starts with an up-down approach, mostly. This is not black and white, but I'm putting it like this so it's easier to understand. And from a paternalistic perspective, you see people more as a passive objects, as clients who actually needs professional help. So from our point of view, Batterie's aim or mandate is to actually follow up people, guide organizations, grassroots organizations, and learn from them and learn with them. Our task is not to impose knowledge or a way of doing things. It's about making people and groups strong and to take control over their own life. So that's kind of our mandate. And I have one example just before we finish. As mentioned, we work a lot with different groups, and we have been working a lot, especially with one group that is quite interesting, and it's undocumented people without rights in Norway. They are called Mennesker I Limbo. And it's interesting because it has been a long process of working with this group, especially because, of course, they are undocumented. They are not. It's difficult to trust for them authorities and other organizations. And our work started in 2012, where the clinic, the health clinic of Sykehusbymisjon and the Red Cross, started to work with one group with self-help group, where they gather different people without documents, illegal immigrants, to talk with each other and to have small conversations to help themselves. And what happened is that there were more, these people that were part of this group, they were more concerned about other things as well, you know, about their social rights, the right to work, the right to participate. Say they wanted something more. So that's how in 2013 they were connected to Batterie. And when they came in contact to Batterie, their main concern was to how can we as a group raise our voice? How can we as undocumented illegal immigrants raise our voice in Norway? And they found out that one way of doing it was to form an organization. And that the name of the organization is Mennesker I Limbo, which is now composed by women and men, various nationalities. You find them in Oslo, but also in some other parts of Norway. And they work with the right to health, the right to work. And they have different activities. For instance, they meet politicians. They take part of demonstrations. They were in Arendal, Arendalsuka, for some weeks ago, and they are working quite a lot. So that's one of the examples we have of many, that how we, in one way, when using batterie effecten, we try to empower groups that have been marginalized and that now, by feeling part of something, can actually create something for themselves and to make a change for their own life. So that's it.
Thank you very much.
Or Paloma, comments? Or comments, yeah. People are getting a little bit
exhausted. It's late.
Yes, you
talked
a
lot about empowerment. But I've met some people who don't want to be empowered. Or Tron, he talked about you have to be willing to live to be able to go forward. How can you empower somebody who was not interested but being empowered? Is it possible at all?
I think empowerment is not something you can impose, you know, first of all. Because empowerment is not a result of something, it's a process. And you have to, in order to actually do it, you need to have a dialogue with the people. And it's something that you cannot do by being outside that silence of culture. According to Freire, he says that the people who can be empowered by themselves are people who actually are from this silence of culture. So you cannot go to a person and say, now you need to be empowered, you know, now it's time to get liberated, you know, because that goes against the principles of what empowerment is. But it's a very long process, and according to our work, it's more about how can you actually be part of a group that feels the same, that have had the same experiences, and find one way, different ways of doing it. And I think the interesting thing here is that Lisa's example was quite interesting, because they found out that soccer was one way of actually getting empowered. You know, it's one method, because you use it as a way to feel part of one community. Sometimes someday you were alone or you felt alone, but by doing it something together or using soccer as an element, you actually feel that you are somebody. You get an identity that is common, and that is, you get empowered through that process. Mm. So that's at least how we understand empowerment. Mm.
I think we just
leave it
at that. Thank you very much.
Well, I will actually give you the present because I forgot the book. The last speaker.
Yeah.
Welcome, Elizabeth. Krapak,
yeah,
from Denmark.
Thank you.
She's a project leader in sport for mental illness, run by the Danish Labour Sport Association and the Danish Olympic Committee.
Yeah.
So, welcome. And the title is, what potential influence may physical activity have on social-related domains?
Yeah. I'll do that, and I'll do it quick. I can see the time is running.
No, it's very interesting topic, yeah. I think. So I thank you for...
Thank you.
Wave your arms.
Thank you.
Well, the last one, are you tired in your head?
Yeah.
Maybe stand up and go down. We are talking about sport where we don't do it. No, we have others to do that. We are just coaching. I like this title. Well, I'm Lisbeth, and I have been working with sport and mental illness people in the organization of in Denmark for the last 20 years. First, I was in a little municipality in Denmark, and now I'm in Copenhagen, Brøndby. So we have been doing a lot of sport with people with mental illness, and we don't say you just have to schizophrenia or you just have to have another diagnostic. We see it's for all. Sport is for all, and we are looking at the human being as you are a person with a lot of energy, with a lot of what you call you mean something to others. So that's the way we look on people. And when we started this, we also have educations, coach educations for people with mental illness. That was a real revolution, because the psychiatrists and the hospitality system in for mental illness, they look like people. If you have a mental illness, you cannot do anything. You have to just the system take care of you, and you just have to listen. We know what the best for you is. And if you have this way to look at people, they will be like this. But in the sport, maybe that's it. We came outside, so the hospitality and the social workers has to learn the sports organizations to know. How do we treat each other? How do we meet each other? And we meet between the sport. And we think that everybody can learn more. Even if you have a mental illness, then you can be a good coach if you want to. So we have education. We have a lot of education to these people. And the most barrier was that the social workers has to be in the same course as a people with mental illness. That was really news for them. They, I'll tell it a little later. I maybe have some slides who tell it. I want you to show one of the girls. She is. She has just started to go in the sports club, where we organize sports clubs for people with mental illness, not for them, but with them. So we try to coach them to take care, to go in the democratic process, and how to learn to behave there. She tells on the video that she also she has never had a job. She is a young girl. She never had a job. She has afraid. She has mental illness. She maybe is a little fat. So people, they just looked at her and put her in a box, and maybe they think that she cannot do anything. But when they had a sports club in the municipality, she go in there and she can do some job.
Når man lever med en sygdom som David og Robert her, så kan det ofte være svært at komme ud af døren og få sig rørt. Men nu er de begge blevet medlemmer af noget anderledes. Idrætsforeningen, de bor på Mors, og her har kommunen som et af de eneste steder i landsdelen lavet et idrætstilbud udelukkende til psykisk sårbare borgere. Og det viser sig, at sved på panden kan gøre en forskel for de psykisk syge.
Ja. Just look for her.
Ja. Hvad er det, at mennesker oplever i løbet af livet, at
blive
ramt af en psykisk
sygdom? Hvis der er mange mennesker, så kan der være angst og hjertebanken.
Overskuddet forsvinder, og ofte ender man med at isolere sig fra omverdenen.
Jeg hedder Robert, og jeg lider af Aspergers syndrom. Det gør vel ikke altid, altså socialt fungerer.
1, 2, 3, hvad skal I have?
Kærlighed!
Men på en fodboldbane i udkanten af Nykøbing er Robert og Daisy blevet en del af en succes.
Godt! Yes! Godt, Henrik!
Så når jeg har det dårligt, så bruger jeg mig meget inde. og mig selv og bare ligger under dynen måske, eller i hvert fald hjemme. Men idrætten, foreningen gør så, at jeg kommer ud blandt nogen, som forstår, hvordan jeg har det.
Det er 2 år siden, at Morsø Kommunes forsøg startede lige Fjords Idrætsforening. Målen.
So if you want to change that, you really have to want to do it, and you have to be strong, and you have to keep going on and pushing, and then you'll have the succeed for the rest. Suddenly you'll have the succeed. Yeah, we know that. I think people have been talking about it this day. That why sport is and what qualities in sport communities we have for people who are outside the ordinary sports organization. It makes relationship between people, break down limits between social workers and patients, and also with people with mental illness. And I think when we have a body-to-body relationship or body talk, then maybe we can talk about a culture, and we had a good communication. Sports, some other speeches told about us today that when you are going in the sport, or maybe that was the girl from United States, she told when she's playing football, her mind is on playing football and not on the other problems. And I think that the more you can move your mind, the more you can move your mind and thinking to being playing football or maybe another sport, then you can better live your life with your problems, or maybe your problems will get away when you are going out of the sport. So and then we can see somebody wants to change their lifestyle. We know that many of these people, they live on junk food. If they have some food, maybe it's often it's junk food. But if they go in the organized clubs where you meet people, they can feel, if I have to be here, if I want to do the sport, I have to have some energy, and the energy comes from healthy food. So it's they find out themselves if they want to go in there. They can they must have something good to eat. Football brings people together, and we also have seen that biking do the same. We have a project going on right now. We call it 100 kilometers for mental health. We started in May, where we have 20 towns, where we have connected people to go come together one time a week, and is bicycling 10 kilometers. The leader and the captain, we call them the bike captain, we call them, they are volunteers, and they want to do something social. So we can see that it means a lot. That people, that volunteers, they want to show people with mental illness, they want to do a difference. And they also come to go the bike ride, even if it's raining. It says more. So that means that they feel that here they can come as they are, and they feel that when they come to the biking, they can feel they are welcome. People respect you. And they also know that if you don't come, people are talking. Why didn't you come last day? Or why? Where is Jens? We can feel he's not here, and you can hear it. People is taking care of you. I think that's different from many places in the system, where you come. If you don't come to the speech with your doctor, it's okay. we don't seen it. But if you miss your bike training. Everybody's seen this because it's important for us that you come. So they take care of each other. I think it's a good, that's the way they have a new culture. So we can see if they feel welcome, they come. And they will be there. And we also is trying to find some new volunteers. The people with mental illness come to Go Bike, and we can see if there's somebody who wants to be the new volunteers, the new captain for the next year. We go and talk with them, see, do you want this? Do you want to do some volunteers work next year? And of course they will. I have heard somebody told here that everybody can use volunteers work, and we see that. So you just have to ask them, even if they have a mental illness. So, yeah, we hope that it could be good for everybody, that we can have a lot of these biking teams show up. I know there was a lot of things that I couldn't tell you about, but if you want to hear more about us, you can go and in our home site, and I can tell you that we have a lot of things here. This brochure is how we work, and this is how we have started to sports. So give the place where people live, the shelters or homestay, where there can be a certification as a sport place. So that's a new. We have we know that if we want to change the health to these people, then we must go out there where they live. So we have to connect the people, the professional, and now is starting to educate them as a sport, give them a sports certification. So I think that could be that we can see that if you involve the professional people and give them education, many of them they want to work in another way. And sport is really simple. Sport, you can do it when you're sitting on your chair. You just have to do it. And we also have here one of the volunteers with mental illness. They tell what it has means to them. So we can see we have a lot of knowledge to tell, but still, we are working with money. We are also fundraising. The Danish Culture Ministry have given us money, but in 2018, we don't have money enough to go further. But I think it's okay. But I think you also know these. I think you have the hurdle too. Yeah. Is there things you want to ask about? I know it's late in the afternoon, and I know it's Danish, yeah?
I think it was really interesting that you were saying we have to go where they are.
Yeah.
And I think that may be a very, very very important thing also to tell our students and ourselves as professionals, that we cannot sit in our offices and wait for people to come.
No. And I also say to the professional people, you have to take your body with when you're going to the work. Don't only take your head, but take your body. You have to give, to give something of yourself.
To get involved.
Yeah, to get involved. So that's, that's the way to do it. Is it? It's quite simple. Very, very, very simple. Yeah. Ja, ja, du beholder bare resten.
No more. You can carry your things back home.
Thank you.
Okay, the last part of the program, we have decided just to run it in Norwegian. I've just discussed with one of the participants here. Anyone not speaking Norwegian or Scandinavian? Yeah. About you. And da tror jeg vi tar den siste oppsummeringen på norsk og svensk og dansk. Ja. Så da det en slus som skal komme med her. Først, tror jeg.
Bare meg?
Ja, jeg tror vi gjorde det. Jeg har tatt litt med de andre studentene også. Men nå det nesten bare familien til stede her. Så vi har jo dette Erasmus Plus-prosjektet som involverer studenter fra tre ulike land. Og vi prøver jo å åpne opp som
vi kan gå litt sånn, det kan sikkert ikke det her, kanskje. Ja.
Og poenget jo å åpne opp dette området her som Bodil snakket om. Altså i forhold til å få kjennskap til de sårbare i samfunnet vårt.
Og da har jo vi hatt flere studentkull i ulike praksisarenaer. Og vi prøver å intervjue dem og få dem til å komme med tilbakemeldinger og fortelle oss hva de syns om de praksisperiodene sine. Og Sjur, han var på gatehospitalet som noen av dere skal få besøke litt senere. Ja, og det et somatisk sykehus for rusmisbrukere i Oslo. Og det er vel de som i aktiv rus. Fordi det vanskelig for dem å være på et vanlig sykehus, fordi de har problemer med å følge regler, og også i kommunehelsetjenesten, fordi de klarer ikke å møte opp på forskjellige steder, så det har vært et behov for å lage et sykehus. Og der får man plager som absesser, brudd, ernæringsproblematikk, traumer, infeksjoner, dårlig sirkulasjon. Og alle andre problemer, og nyresvikt ikke minst, det har jo vært et stort problem det siste året, på grunn av at heroinen har vært så skitten, så de får nyresvikt. Og så har vi hatt studenter, og der det en herre- og en dameavdeling, og det har de også skilt, fordi at kvinnene ofte jobber i prostitusjon, og synes det ganske belastende å måtte være sammen med menn, når de har en sånn liten time-out-periode. Og ja, det var litt, det noen andre som har sagt noe om det her i dag også, tror jeg. Men jeg tenkte, Sjur, fordi du var der i, når var du der egentlig?
Var du i fjor høst? Jeg var i praksis i fjor høst, det var jeg, og så jobbet jeg jo der etterpå.
Ja.
Det gjorde jeg.
Ja, og vi spurte deg vel bare om du ville...
Nei, jeg ble ikke spurt engang.
Nei, du bare fikk
beskjed. Ja. Det gjorde jeg.
Ja, vi har en slags sånn, ja, illusjon om at vi spør, men vi gjør, nei. Ja.
Jeg ble bare plassert, men det greit. Så det var veldig spennende det. Jeg visste jo ingenting før jeg skulle da.
Nei.
Så jeg googlet det jo bare, og så tenkte jeg, skal jeg jobbe med rusmisbrukere? Det ble jo spennende.
Mm-hmm. Det har du ikke gjort før?
Har jeg ikke gjort før. Det kan bli skummelt, tenkte jeg.
Mm-hmm.
Og så var jeg jo der, og så ble jo hele illusionen om rusmisbrukere bare snudd helt om, eller at de, ja, de på en måte mennesker, og de ikke så skumle. De kan liksom mye. Vi hadde quiz til frokost hver dag, og de knuste jo meg mange ganger, for jeg har jo ikke, de kan jo så mye, og kan jo mye mer enn meg om ting. Så jeg ble liksom fascinert over hva mennesker de er. Det gjorde jeg.
Og jeg vet jo at de lederne der, de sier jo på alle introduksjoner til studentene, så sier de også at det vi synes det aller viktigste er at man ikke, at ikke rusmisbruket i sentrum, men det mennesket bak rusmisbruket som det veldig viktig å forholde seg til.
Mm.
Og det det de opptatt av hele tiden. De jo selvfølgelig opptatt av å hjelpe folk ut av rusen, men gjennom å se de som de menneskene de bak rusen.
Mm. Mm, det får du jo tid til, eller du... De ruser seg jo ikke der, så du får jo bli kjent med menneskene bak rusen. Du ser jo ikke den rusa personen på en måte.
Nei.
Så du blir jo veldig godt kjent med de og ser hva muligheter de har og ja, hvor flinke de er.
Men hva synes du, hvordan hadde vi forberedt dere fra utdanningens side da, sånn teoretisk?
Skal jeg være ærlig?
Eller? Ja, du skal være ærlig. Ja.
Dritdårlig egentlig, men jeg visste jo nesten ingenting om det.
Nei.
Og ja, jeg... hadde ikke snøring på hva jeg gikk til, liksom.
Nei.
Så det var jo å lære den harde måten, men jeg har lært mye, det har jeg. Men jeg skulle jo lært veldig mye mer om i alla fall sån psykisk sjukdom. Mm. Hur du ska tackla det och snacka med dig och om rus och hur den det påverkar.
Mm.
Det borde man ha varit förberett på. Men nu har jag fått lärt väldigt mycket.
Ja. Vi har ju haft alltså vi har ju på något sätt kommunikationsteori och så har vi etik och så har vi lite patologi om rus. Men alltså jag vet inte hur mycket det går an att lära för att läsa böcker heller.
Nej.
Eller hur skulle vi gjort det? Eller kanske man kunde ha haft några seminargrupper eller
alltså en hel pedagogik. Jo, det bästa hade ju gärna varit att fått någon historia av någon som är inne i det och får du verkligen sett hur det är och ja.
Nu har vi filmat idag då. Ja. Så vi kan bruka det i undervisningen.
Ja. Det är så dumt. Så är det de de första som var snackade där idag har ju också många historier om hur det är och de
det är sådana resurser
som kan vara med och bruka.
Mm.
Det är det.
Ja, jag vet att de gör det på medicinstudenter bland annat. De har.
För det är ju en krävande grupp att jobba med. Kan du inrömma det? Att jag har ju både varit sliten och sur och rädd. Och så det är ju en helt annan måte att jobba på. Men det har ju gett mig så mycket mer än alla andra fysioterapi då.
Mm.
Därför jag brukar hela mig som person. Och inte bara fysioterapeut.
Mm.
Och då ger det mig mycket. Så då är det helt rätt att vara lite rädd eller lite sur eller lite sliten en dag du är på jobb när du får följa att du ger lite mening.
Mm. Har du någon exempel som du tänker att kan vara nytt att dela?
Ja, jag har ju många, men det var ju en speciellt en patient som var väldigt i begynnelsen när man var där så snackade han som med någon han bara såg väck och satt för sig själv. Så tänkte jag att kan man prova att jobba lite med det. Så började jag att snacka lite med han. Drack mycket kaffe. Det går väldigt mycket kaffe på gatuhospitalet. Men det är ju en kaffe med mening. För du blir känt med det och skapar en relation. Och så gick jag tur med han ute. Och då lösnade lite mer av samtal. Vi blev känt, skapade relationen. Så tog jag med en tur i träningsrummet. Och så lösnade allt för han. Han blev en av de mer aktiva och snackade som en gal. Och skapade skicklig stämning i gruppen. Liksom, för det att han fick... Ja. Utfolda sig och ja, det gav mening.
Och många här har sagt det där med tid, att tid är så otroligt viktig. Det är väl viktigt att inte ha det travelt då, eller vart på.
Ja, så man hörte ju det om sån intervallträning och maximal styrketräning och sånt. Det hade du så nytta och tagit dig med på det. I alla fall de färraste av det. Det är mer att skapa något sån lustbetont på gatuhospitalet och ta dig med i träningsrummet. Gör några enkla övningar och flytta tankarna lite, sånt som jag snackar eller så blir snackat mycket om. Eller gå en tur. Spel bordtennis eller ha gett massage för att få liksom positiv kroppslig kontakt och du kan liksom inte förvänta och helbreda dig på en timme. Det är något sån quick fix det är liksom, men det kan ge små sån lyspunkter och ja, små positiva ögonblick. Och det är det ju så alla de som har så mycket.
Det har flera sagt om här och så något som det flashes.
Mm.
Alltså det tänker inte vara så långt en gång, men bara att du har varit som inom och blir minnet om att du faktiskt kan uppleva något som är positivt.
Mm. Var någon av de som har fått massage har liksom sagt att den på något en positiv erfarenhet med kroppen och det har de sagt på länge. De har gärna bara rusat sig och kanske känt på kroppen i det hela tatt och bara känna att kroppen har blivit brukt något bra eller om de har tränat eller fått massage eller samma vad det är, men positiva erfarenheter med kroppen.
Men vad var det som gjorde att du fortsatte att jobba där då som efter att du hade varit där i praxis?
Nej, jag trivdes så gott. Jag kände att det gav mening och att de flesta partner dagarna så hade jag inte lust att gå hem egentligen för det att det var så käckt. Så kände jag att jag som sagt, jag fick brukt mig själv på en god måte att inte bara fysiosjur men personsjur också att jag fick god relation med många av dem och då är det ju väldigt käckt så syns jag att de är väldigt kule folk som både jobbar där och är patienter så det är ju käckt att liksom gå runt i Oslo och träffa folk på gata och slå av en part och ja, det ger mening. Och så må ju de ha likt mig lite i ledarna då, siden jag fick jobb lite.
Ja, fick lite sånt tillbaka. Ja, men så att du lärer något om dig själv?
Ja, det gör jag absolut. Jag får ju brutt ner alla fördomar. För det kan ju vara skummelt hvis du inte har peiling på vad det är och går igenom Brugata för exempel. Så hvis der springer inn og hauger og skriker, og så kan det være skummelt hvis du ikke vet helt hva det er for noe. Det kan det jo, og ja. Men det har utviklet meg som person, det mener jeg.
Men så, for jeg tenker at rus finnes jo i alle samfunnslag og i sosiale klasser og sånn, og når man jobber som fysioterapeut så treffer man jo folk fra alle lag. Har du liksom, vil du gjenkjent noe? Altså det er sånn, jeg lurer på, gjenkjenner man en slags type rusatferd? Altså kunne man avdekket noe tidligere, eller stilt mer direkte spørsmål til folk om de har et rusproblem? Altså vil du turte å gjøre det?
Ja, altså først så tenkte jeg jo at, for jeg visste jo selv hvordan jeg skulle forholde meg til den type pasientgrupper, så jeg prøvde jo å ikke gå, eller jeg gikk liksom rundt grøden og ikke snakket så direkte, men jeg forstod jo at mange av de likte at du bare kalte spada for spada, og det går helt fint å snakke direkte. Og det har jo hjulpet meg å ja, stille mer sånn direkte og kvasse spørsmål da, som kan være litt ubehagelige, men det er lettere å oppdage ting da.
Er det noe når du er i turnus også, eller?
Ja, du finner jo personer som ruser seg overalt. Det gjør du jo.
Selv i Stavanger?
Selv i Stavanger, så er det det. Og det er jo, de er jo innom sykehus ofte, de har jo mye problemer. Det har de jo.
Tror du det hadde vært behov for et gatehospital i Stavanger?
Ja, det bygger vel i Bergen, så det...
Ja,
vi
gjør det.
Jeg tror det kan være behov for de fleste, eller i mange byer i hvert fall, at de har en plass å gå mellom sykehus og der de bor, eller gator, eller hvor noe enn det er, at de ikke bare blir kastet rett ut før de... Ja, for sykehus så kaster de ut med en gang, det gjør de jo med alle, så... Eller, det er bare et par dager.
Skal vi åpne for litt spørsmål? Fra salen. Bodil?
Ja, jeg tenker på om... Om du var syk i morgen, og jeg skulle vikariere for deg, hva ville du da anbefale meg å bringe med meg som kompetanse for at jeg greide å jobbe på gatehospitalet?
Først og fremst så tror jeg du ville kommet langt med, eller at du er åpen og ser personen bak rusen, og ser mennesket, og ser behovene deres, eller utfordringene. Fordi de har jo gjerne brudd i ryggen, absess, store sår. Så hva skal du begynne med? Hva skal du gjøre? Så da gjelder det å se personen, og hva kan gi den personen en positiv opplevelse. Og ja, jeg vet ikke om det var svar på. Men at du i hvert fall er åpen og ser mennesket, og så tar det derfra. Nå vil folk hjem.
Det er litt hva de sier, de studentene som har vært der nede noen dager.
Ja, kan vi ikke høre litt? Å nei, nå er fru... Har det gått? Nei, men vi kan høre litt fra de som har vært nede på, i teltet.
Ja.
Ja. For dere har jo akkurat... Nei, vi kan sitte her og snakke med dem, kan vi ikke det?
Det kan
vi.
Ja, skal vi bare sitte her?
Ja, det kan vi. Kan ikke de som sitter litt langt bak og ikke hører, så kan dere komme litt. Skal de ned? Vil dere at de skal komme ned? Nei, bare sitt der. Litt sånn erfaringer fra å være i teltet og jobbe med gatefotballspillere. Det har jo alle gjort, det er ikke bare de norske, det er jo svenske og danske studenter også. Har du
sikkert? Det er jo en annen måte å jobbe på. Det er første gang vi får vært borte i noe akutt. At det bare kommer inn, og så skal de... Ja, og gjerne skade seg der og da. Man skal fikse opp i det, for de skal gjerne rett ut igjen. For ellers så er det mye kronikere vi har borte. Så det er samme å faktisk se om noe som har skjedd der og da. Og så tenke litt kjapt, og samarbeide godt for å få de fort ut igjen. Og så heller da få de tilbake igjen, så vi kan se på de etterpå hjemme. Men det å tenke litt kjapt, og ja, stole på seg selv, og ja, være en god samarbeidspartner også.
synes det veldig lurt å ta de casene som kommer inn. Selv om man kanskje ikke helt sikker, så finner man en løsning på det som er litt. Og prøver å spørre de hvordan de oppfatter det, og hvordan de føler det.
Rasmus?
Ja. Noget af det, der har overrasket mig mest, er faktisk, at den her marginalisering har der ikke været særlig meget af, synes jeg ikke. Altså, de bliver set som mennesker på samme fod, som alle andre gør. Det er ikke i samme grad, som jeg havde forestillet mig hjemløse, eller stofmisbrugere, eller psykisk sårbare. Det er bare folk, der spiller fodbold, har det fedt med det, har lidt ondt i anklen. Så det var en fed ord. Nogle af dem er lidt specielle, eller hvad man skal sige. Altså, man kan godt mærke, at der er lidt noget med nogle af dem, men det er langt fra alle.
Ja. De fleste, alle er veldig hyggelige hvis man bare tar seg tid til å stoppe opp og hilse på dem. Også bare hei, jeg heter Arne, og så ta det derfra. Også. Da roer de sakte litt med, og så ja, bare å få den lille sånne at de er å bli hilse på. Og så er det veldig hyggelig å prate med hvis man bare er før.
Selv
om det går på engelsk og litt gebrokent. Ja, det er veldig hyggelige folk. Ja. Jeg synes bare det er fantastisk å være nede. Det er så mye glede, og så mye folk overalt, og det er så godt samhold, og det er mye mer enn fotball, det er så tydelig. Jeg bare blir kjempesliten, men det er bare for så mye energi. Jeg kommer hjem og bare snakker om de jeg bor hjemme, og hvordan sånn har det vært der? Hva har det vært gøy? For det er så mye glede, det er så mye energi, og et godt arbeid mellom danskere, med svenskere, med nordmenn, og mellom alle spillere og trenere, og det er alle hjelp for andre, og det er så veldig kjent for det da. Så det er bare, hvis ikke det har vært der nede og sett på kamp, så anbefaler dere å komme. Det er ordentlig fotball og fotball.
Men vi må prøve å finne ut også litt mer sånn i forhold til læringsmål og i forhold til hvordan vi skal forberede dere bedre. Altså vi skal kanskje prøve å endre litt på utdanningen også, men jeg synes jo at danskene hadde et veldig fint framlegg her, så jeg tenkte, der har de tatt hele oppsummeringen for oss, liksom. Men vi jobber jo med disse tingene hele tiden underveis når vi møtes for å prøve å finne gode løsninger. Så vi er helt avhengig av tilbakemelding fra dere.
NM var egentlig ganske fint å være med på sånn, for det var litt sånn mindre enn dette. Jeg tror sånn for å komme litt inn i det og se litt hva det er, for det er færre dager, og da, ja, for å vite litt hva man går til da, for det er jo en helt ny greie. Vi kommer rett fra skolebenkene og sånn til at det er ekte pasienter, og de kommer nå og kjapt, og ja. Men det går fint, og ja.
Og det som slår meg er at det er ikke alle skadene som er like alvorlige, eller veldig alvorlige. Men poenget er at du kan da avdramatisere situasjonen, og det er en veldig god helseeffekt. At du kan si at nei, du har ikke brukket noe ribben, bare liksom varme opp godt og gå på banen, kom tilbake hvis ikke det går over da, liksom. Og det er også ganske mye læring i da, å kunne liksom gjøre en rask sjekk og tenke at man må bare ja, se om ikke dette går over av seg selv, ja. Fikk jeg gitt en massasje da. Og det tenker jeg også sånn, om det ikke har noen sirkulatorisk effekt, så fikk jeg undersøkt det låret veldig godt. Jeg fikk et slags inntrykk av den muskulaturen og tenkte, her kan det være fint med litt uttøying og litt nedtrapping etter alle disse kampene, som blir en ganske høy dosering av trening da, for utrente mennesker. Så jeg tenker at mye av det man gjør sånn helt ad hoc, det får man mye kunnskap ut av da. Det er nok nytt da. Du har ikke vært med på gatefotball da? Det er jo gatefotballlag i Stavanger, vet du.
Ja. Får være med det.
Ja. Bare pense deg inn. Ja, fortell.
De fleste fotballer visste nok ikke om det, eller de la ikke merke til det, for det var bare en sånn liten linje på plasser. Så det gikk i glemmeboka at folk på en måte ikke satt av meg inn i det da. Så kanskje det å snakke litt høyere om det, at folk faktisk forstår hva det handler om, litt i hvert fall, fordi at folk visste ikke hva det var for noe, og da ble det bare, er det
Var det gatefotballen?
Ja. Ja. Og sånn generelt Norden for full lås, så vet jeg ikke om mange av oss 10 som har på praksisendringen som faktisk vet hva det
Nei. Jeg lurer på om vi skal runde av og si tusen takk for i dag og takk for at dere kom og takk for at dere her og takk til Sju som har kommet hele veien fra Stavanger.